Coming up on a very special edition of Sports and Stuff, a special guest joins me for the first time on Exquisite Podcast Radio Network to talk all about one of my favorite books that he's written. I'll talk all about that as well as the latest sports news and entertainment right here on Sports and Stuff. It's all coming up in just a moment right after these short messages here on Sports and Stuff. Stay tuned.
You've got to plug into EPRN. We've got the conversation, we've got the sports team, and our music and entertainment team brings podcasting to extremely new heights.
Listen in to EPRN.us. Press the app button on the site and download the EPRN app now. You'll be listening to shows in no time. Take us on the go with you. Our app is accessible on all mobile devices and tablets. Or you can just go to EPRN.us.
Your listening is worth your time.
Spend your time listening to an independently owned media network.
Tell a friend and listen in.
Exquisite Podcast Radio Network, EPRN.
Proud sponsor of Sports and Stuff, Harold's Ice Cream has over 400 original flavors to select from. Best of all, Harold's is kosher certified, no moo or artificial ingredients. Harold's also makes ice cream cakes with real cake centers, and they also ship their frozen treats to customers. Harold's Ice Cream makes treats like frozen yogurt, sherbet, brownies, cookies, pies, and cakes. Harold's does it all to satisfy that sweet, healthy treat craving. They cater events for 70 people or more, and they ship their kosher treats by mail. Call Harold's Ice Cream today at 413-586-9700 and visit harolds.com. Village Pizza is the family-owned East Hampton, Massachusetts establishment that has been serving the local community for over 40 years. Well known for their delicious Greek-style pizza pies and the best local spot to go hang out and watch a Celtics, Bruins, Red Sox, or Patriots game, Village Pizza, 100 Union Street, East Hampton. And welcome to Sports and Stuff, everyone. Glad you could join us this week on a very special episode of Sports and Stuff. I am joined by an author of the book Slimed, an oral history of Nickelodeon's golden age of television, which was written about 5 or 6 years ago. He's written a number of other famous books, which we will talk about here on the program. I recently reached out to him, and he was very kind enough to respond to me. It's my pleasure to welcome author Matthew Klickstein to the Sports and Stuff media platform here on EPRN. Matthew, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. So now, as we start the show here this week, the reason I have Matt here, for one thing, is because, for one thing, we're both very big Nickelodeon fans of a lot of the older shows. But as I mentioned, he wrote the Slime book a while back, and recently, within this past year, wrote a revised edition of the book, which we'll get to here in a little bit. But, Matt, I wanted to start by asking this. What inspired you to write the Slime book in the first place when you did? So tell me the whole story behind that.
It's fairly simple. I've been writing ever since I can remember. I've always been a big writer. I knew it was going to be something that I'd probably do professionally as I started deciding on vocations. I started doing journalism work as early as 15. I was, of course, involved in my school newspaper and yearbook. And did a lot of writing on the side and so forth. I went to film school for screenwriting at USC, and while I was there, I started doing a lot of film reviews and writing about a lot of pop culture topics for local newspapers in Los Angeles and the like. I don't know how else to put it aside from sometime around 2007 or 8, I just realized that there was really no book on Nickelodeon aside from a couple of academic texts. And it was just something that needed to be discussed because as we were getting older, at that time I was in my mid-20s, as a lot of people in our generation were. Of course, I just realized, these were some very special programs, these Nickelodeon shows in the 80s and early 90s that inspired a lot of us in our generation. I could tell that films that were starting to come out and music and other books and things were written and made by people who were clearly inspired by shows like Adventures of Pete and Pete and Double Dare and You Can't Do That Television, Are You Afraid of the Dark? And I just decided I wanted to try to make it happen. At that time, I really didn't have too many connections in the publishing world. But over the following few years, I got myself an agent. I started writing some articles about Nickelodeon at her suggestion when I decided, you know, now's the time to give it a shot, especially right after the MTV book had come out. And we said, hey, if an MTV book come out, let's do one on Nickelodeon. And the articles were written for Splitsider, which is now owned by Vulture. And they started doing really well, and we started getting some interest. I put together a proposal, and about 6 months later, my agent sold it. So really, it was about, you know, just a personal interest. I grew up on shows. I loved these shows. I wanted an opportunity to talk to the people who were behind them and write about it. And also on a professional level, I just realized, as did my agent, it was time for a book like this to come out. And indeed, we came out right at the beginning of a lot of the kind of Nickelodeon nostalgia renaissance, as we call it. That was right when some of the reboots started happening and a lot of the reunions and things started happening. Many of them I was very involved in. So the timing of it was just perfect. And of all the things I've done, you're right, for good or ill, it seems that's the book that keeps coming up and that people want to keep talking with me about. And, you know, I'm very proud of it. It was a really, really hard process getting it all done, especially in those days. Before, you know, social media was really big, I had to track everybody down and kind of stuff. They weren't just, you know, available on a Facebook page or something like that necessarily. But I'm glad I did it. And, you know, a lot of ups and downs over the past few years through that process. But, you know, it's a book that I'm really happy with and always happy to talk to people like yourself about.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, you know, as time has gone on, our generation has really grown to appreciate these shows even more, because you don't see shows like them on TV anymore. It's just so different now than it used to be. I mean, kids these days are so much different than they were back in the, like, the 80s and 90s. So I remember, you know, you were mentioning, like, reboots and revivals. Like, I remember when the 90s or all that was starting on Teen Nick back in about 2011, as it was, now it's called Nick Rewind, but they've changed it a couple times. But I remember when that was starting, you know, I think around that time is when I started to kind of get back into, like, you know, classic Nickelodeon. I'd always liked it. I just kind of forgotten about it for so long. And then when I heard about your book, as well as another individual that I think you may have talked to before, a Bilal Smith, who came out with a project about the Nickelodeon Studios called the Nick Studios Past, Present, and Future, that really piqued my interest, because he started interviewing people who worked in Nick Studios, and I'm thinking, like, you know, this may be onto something big here. And then your book came out, and then it's like, and it was like all Nickelodeon. It was like a party almost, you know, with classic Nickelodeon people. So, but now let me ask you this: when you were writing the book, who were some of your favorite people you interviewed? Anybody stand out in particular?
That's a really good question. You know, one of the things that was really great about this process is many of the people that I met and interviewed, and I spoke to over 250 people involved in different facets of all the different Nickelodeon shows we've been talking about. But a few of them have become lifelong friends. And, you know, of those, a few of them, it was pretty clear right away that we were going to become really close. We just really clicked and started hanging out, and it was really great to get to know some of these people so well. You know, one of the really big ones, and he was also just very helpful with the book, and he was very helpful with a lot of the different promotional events and things that we've done over the years, is definitely Nick Arcade host Phil Moore. Phil has become one of my closest friends just in general, and I still well remember being in the car with my roommate at the time. I was living in Boulder, Colorado. The first time I'm living here again now, with a little 5-year period in between where I wasn't here. But I remember being in the car with my roommate, and Phil called, and I literally turned to my roommate, put my hand over the phone, and said, "It's Phil Moore from Nick Arcade," because I had left a message at his office or whatever it was, and he called me back. And I remember the excitement of that, and how special that was, and how great Phil was during his initial interviews for the book. And now, you know, he's somebody that I talk to fairly frequently. We just talked actually very recently about a new project that he wants to try to put together that I might be helping with. And, you know, we'll get into this a little bit more. But, yeah, I had a fifth anniversary edition of Slime that came out a couple months ago with a few updates and things. But one of the things that makes it really cool is Phil did a new introduction. And he actually kind of talked about how much the book and a lot of the events that happened with the book really helped to get him back into the limelight again, and helped a lot of other Nickelodeon people get going again. I mean, when I was working on the book, and I was starting to talk to people, many of them had not thought about these things for a very long time. Many of them had left the industry entirely. Many of them weren't even in touch with each other anymore. I started kind of becoming a networker. A few people joked, wow, Nickelodeon would probably love your contact list. You know, again, over the last few years, a lot of these people have popped up on social media or doing other things now and whatnot. But Phil talks about in the introduction, and he said this in a lot of other interviews and things, that really he feels this book helps people like himself and others say, hey, you know what, there's still interest for the kinds of things we do, for who we are. And again, I help to connect a lot of people back together again, so that some of these reunions and things could happen. So Phil's always been a really great supporter. Jason Zimbler's another one who played Ferguson on Clarissa Explains It All. I still well remember the first time we met. I was in New York, and we actually had a drink at the Algonquin Hotel, the famous Algonquin Hotel where the Algonquin Circle would meet Dorothy Parker and Alec Wolcott and Harpo Marx and a lot of those great writers and film people from the 1920s. So Jason and I are having this great conversation. We had a few more interviews. I interviewed a lot of people more than once just to get, you know, make sure all the facts are straight and everything. And Jason was another one who we became lifelong friends, and he was always very supportive of the book, very helpful, very honest in his interviews. I'll say the same thing about Phil. You know, they were warts and all in their interviews and talked a lot about the ups and downs of being involved in the show. It wasn't just kind of PR publicity spin, as so many things are these days, unfortunately. So they're really great, and Jason remains a very close friend. I was actually just in New York, and I was supposed to meet up with him, but we didn't have a chance. But usually I'll stay with him and his very nice wife. They just had a kid, actually. Jason was actually out here visiting in Denver, and he came and saw my wife, and I'm back in Boulder, as I said. So they were great. Fred Seibert, who now runs Frederator Studios and, you know, executive producer of a lot of shows like Castlevania and, of course, Adventure Time and Fairly Odd Parents and a lot of other things. And is just really killing it in the animation world for streaming services like Amazon and Netflix and Hulu. When I was in New York, I just had breakfast with Fred, and another guy who's just really knows what he's talking about. And this is a man who is very involved in the birth of a lot of channels, not just Nickelodeon, obviously MTV and a lot of other things of that nature. So he really knows the history of cable television like nobody else. And it's always great talking with him and interviewing him and meeting with him. I've even been trying to develop a few new projects with him, possibly. So he was always really helpful and really great. You know, obviously there were a lot of other people, many of whom I thanked in the first edition of the book. It's got a rather lengthy special thanks, as some people noticed. It was my first real big book. I'd done a few smaller independent publishers and that kind of thing. That was my first big one. I felt so happy and so elated that I wanted to thank, like, everybody I've ever met, and kind of went a little hog wild with it. Up a little bit with the fifth anniversary edition. The special thanks is a little bit more concise. But yeah, there were so many people who were so helpful. Jeffrey Darby was great, who was vice president of Nickelodeon at the time, kind of ran things with Jerry Laybourne. He was always really good for an interview and told me whatever I needed to know. Steve Slopkin, the creator of Slit Your Shorts, remains a good friend and was also very helpful. DJ McHale, creator of Are You Afraid of the Dark, I just talked to him again recently. Actually, we'll get into this maybe in a little bit, but I feel strongly that some of the aspects of my comic book series were in part inspired by growing up on Are You Afraid of the Dark, and he really appreciated that. So, you know, there were a lot of people that I became very close with. There were a lot of people who were really helpful with interviews and were always there for promotional stuff. Michael Ray Bauer is another example, who played Donkey Lips on Slit Your Shorts. We've gotten really close over the years. And a really, really good guy. It's funny that his character on the show is kind of this mean guy, and sort of a bully of sorts. But in reality, Michael turned out to be one of the nicest people that I dealt with and that I talked to. You know, I'll just wrap this up by saying, and I've said this before too, I felt really lucky that, and I think it says a lot about how and why these shows were as good as they were and why they were so special to us. The people behind them, and many of the actors too, even, they turn out to be really good people. I mean, some of them many of them I interviewed multiple times in person, over the phone, video, whatever it was. So I really got to know them fairly well. And as I said, there was a nice large handful of people that I became friendly with, would hang out with, that I'm still friends with to this day. There was really only that I can think of maybe two or three quote unquote divas or people that were kind of difficult to deal with or whatever, which is, you know, fine. They don't owe me anything. But, you know, with 250 people that I spoke to, that only about two or three were kind of, you know, a little challenging to work with or deal with or whatnot. I think that says a lot. And I think that that's one of the reasons why these shows were so special. The people behind them, for the most part, were really smart, really good people, good friends, good to each other, and definitely good to me and to the book over the years. And I feel really grateful about that. So, and you know, I'll just say too, you know, sometimes you write an article or you interview somebody, you write a book about something that, you know, maybe you're not too sure about, you know, some rock star who, you know, wasn't such a great person or whatever it is, but made really great music or whatever. And, you know, you feel a little conflicted about it. We all have to do those kinds of things for good or ill. With this, though, I'm just really happy that the Nickelodeon book, for the most part, includes interviews not only with really smart and interesting people who made these great shows, but people who I can stand by as human beings for the most part. And that feels really good, too, you know. So that's nice.
That's awesome. I mean, that must feel great knowing that you were responsible for kind of like reuniting a lot of people back together who worked on these shows. It's great what social networking and social media can do with sometimes, like with things like this. It can really bring back people together. Now let me ask you, I think you kind of answered this, but what does it feel like knowing that you made such a positive impact on so many fans of Nickelodeon and on these people that worked on these shows by bringing them all back together again? What did that mean to you and to them?
You know, again, I give this one over to Phil for the most part. He really did such a great job of writing about this in the new introduction for Slime. And I think, you know, further proof of it is I told him he could write whatever he wanted. I just gave him total carte blanche. I did not expect for him. I was actually a little surprised that he chose to write about the book itself and how the book impacted and influenced his life and his career and really his revisiting his career again. And I know that it was real because he's talked about it in other interviews. When he and I have met up when I'm in LA or whatever it is, you know, he brings that up. I know it's something he really believes in. He wasn't just saying it just to be nice or, you know, to be friendly. He really feels strongly that the book had an impact on his life by kind of reminding people about him, reminding people about the show, getting people to talk about it again. As you said, you know, reintroducing him to people that he hadn't seen or talked to in a very long time. And this is something that a lot of the other actors and you know, the show creators and such behind the scenes told me as well. That, you know, the book is warts and all as it needed to be. I didn't want it to just be a fanboy tribute. You know, obviously, for the most part, it's very positive. Because it was, you know, for the most part, a fairly positive time. But that said, you know, there were some darker stories and some things that need to be in there. And no one really brought that up to me or complained or seemed upset or like that for the most part. You know, so I think everybody was pleased with how the book came out. There was one or two small errors that I fixed in the new edition and mentioned in the special thanks afterward. You know, for the most part, it seemed we got everything right and people were very happy with it. And yeah, they were happy to be reconnected. They were happy to kind of have some limelight back on them again. A few people really kind of used some of the attention they got from the book coming out and some of these events that we did and that I set up all around the country that they would come to or whatnot to really try to restart their own careers and such. And a few people told me outright that's why they did it. People like Phil and some others. So yeah, of course that makes me feel really good. And as I said earlier, you know, you might end up writing about a filmmaker or a musician or a politician or whatever who, you know, maybe has done some good stuff, but also some bad stuff and whatever it might be. And, you know, sometimes you feel a little conflicted about it, but, you know, the interview needs to get done or the article needs to get written or whatever your assignment is. In this case, it just felt really good that for the most part, you know, I was talking about what I believe to be good people who are doing good things. Their hearts were in the right place. You know, it's 5-6 years later. Many of them, like I said, I still talk to regularly. I've gotten to know really well. And, you know, that makes me, it's a positive book overall. And it was a positive situation to have all these special events and things that we did. And yeah, as you said, people would come. And that first one, of course, you know, historic in note, at the 92nd Y, where we had 40 different, you know, Nick VIPs come. It was like this 3-hour-long event, the first live show of the Beats. We had the guys from Double Dare play the music from that. You know, a bunch of different things were going on. Sid Strzok, Fingerling from Ms. Fingerling from Pete and Pete. And, you know, just it was really cool to be in the back, in the green room, so to speak, or in the back area, You know, a little cramped, a little crowded. The show went a little longer than it was supposed to, and that was a little difficult for everybody. But, you know, they stuck through it, and, you know, it was really great hearing and seeing people see each other for the first time in 20 years and hug each other and kiss each other and say, yeah. Tears were rolling down people's eyes who hadn't seen each other in 15, 20, 30 years. And, yeah, it felt really good to be the person who put that all together. Honestly, mm-hmm. You know, I believe that it was inevitable that something like this was going to happen. If I hadn't done it, someone else probably would have come along and done it. And, of course, there's been, as you said, Bilal Smith, he's got his podcast show, and there's a lot of other people who do Nickelodeon podcast shows. There's a lot of different documentaries mm-hmm. and such that have been put together mm-hmm. over the years and are still in production. And other people have written books about these different mm-hmm. shows. Thad's book about Ren and Stimpy. There's a kid who wrote a book about Are You Afraid of the Dark? I mean, there's all these other things that have come out, and I think someone would eventually have put this together, but it feels good that I was the one who got to do it, and mm-hmm. I think that the timing was really right, too. It was right when all this stuff was really starting to get hot, and so it was great to kind of be a part of that and to help make it happen. And now here we are 5-6 years later, and, you know, it's still a book that people are talking about and referencing, and it comes up every now and then in a different article or whatever it is. You know, people reference it. People sometimes reference it without crediting it, but that's okay, too. But there's times where I'll read something and go, gee, that looks familiar. I think that's out of my book, buddy. You could have said something, but hey, you know.
A little acknowledgement would be nice every now and then, but now it's funny you mentioned the 92 Y. I actually saw that on YouTube not too long after it happened, and I mean I wasn't there in New York the night it happened, but I did watch it. It was a fantastic event. I mean, every classic Nick star was there. You said Mark Summers was there, Phil Moore was there. I mean, the Double Dare people were there. I mean, Ed Kalehoff, who wrote the music for Double Dare and a lot of classic game shows, was there. I mean, that was incredible. I mean, you had like so many people there, and I mean, boy, that must have been so exciting to be there. And you know, to hear Mark Summers talk about Double Dare, I mean, some of the things he said were kind of funny. Like I remember one of them was something like he mentioned something about somebody wanting a Double Dare birthday party or something, and he promised them that and to be nice, you know, just to like kind of get them away from them, and he's like, and they ask him like, so did you actually end up doing that? And he's like, F no, what are you crazy? I don't want those people. I won't swear because I'm more professional, but it was funny, and it was just a tremendous event that they put on at that time. Now let me ask you about the book here. One of the biggest conclusions that I got reading it was that, you know, a lot of these kids at the time when they were first on these shows, you know, they weren't famous or household names. So when they would go back home after they were done filming for like the season or however many number of shows they were filming, they weren't looked at as celebrities. I mean, a lot of them were actually kind of almost belittled for it. Like they would get bullied in school by other kids. They were, like, other people were jealous of them, you know. At first, some people didn't really take too kindly to it, and it affected them, you know, very negatively for a little while, and it took them a while to kind of get past that. So I thought that was just kind of interesting reading some of these, you know, personal stories from people, how they got treated or how they thought they got looked at by the general public, because they knew they wouldn't be famous forever. I mean, they didn't want to turn into like a child star gone bad, like, you know, like some other shows have. So I just found that so interesting that some of these people would, you know, just hearing their side of it was just so fascinating. I mean, I don't think you would have heard or read that anywhere else. What did you think about some of the things people were telling you that you wrote in the book?
Yeah, I was a little surprised and disheartened to hear some of the difficulties that some of these people went through. You know, I don't want to name any names, but that one of the girls that I spoke to who was actually quite difficult to get in touch with, and I'll just say she was, you know, for good or ill, she was not one of the more famous people. She's someone who left the industry entirely. It looks like other people have had trouble tracking her down when they've tried interviewing her about the show she was on and whatnot. And I remember, but you know, I was able to get her, you know, a little trick I'm able to do. I'm pretty good at getting people to do the interviews. And she was great when we actually did it. But at one point, she was talking about something and she started to cry on the phone, and she was just talking about And it was nothing, you know, I don't even think it was something on set or whatever it was, and it wasn't any kind of really, really bad thing, but it was more of just, I think it brought it back to when she was a kid, and yeah, it was sort of, had some trouble in high school with some of the kids making fun of her and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, that's a lot of what was going on, is a lot of these kids had to live a double life. They were not Hollywood stars. You're right about that. Before, and many of them even after, these were pretty much average, regular, everyday kids, you know, with acne and braces, and, you know, one mm-hmm. of them's cross-eyed, you know, and you can't do that on television, Vanessa, and we talk a little bit about that in the book, and, you know, I think that's another reason that we connected with these shows, and why they remain unique mm-hmm. and special. We don't really see that in movies or TV anymore. Nickelodeon yes. is doing something very unique in showing regular, average, everyday kids who, you know, were a little heavier, a little shorter, a little skinnier, or, you know, didn't have the nicest hair, weren't wearing a lot of makeup. They looked like regular kids that you knew down the street, and one of the reasons why is almost all of them were. And so they had to live this double life of being on this TV show and getting to go to some of these fun events at Nickelodeon Studios or whatever it is, and feeling like they're, you know, like, you know, lords of the land, so to speak. And then, you know, they come home and they go to school, and yeah, the other kids are making fun of them because they're jealous or whatever it might be. And it was really difficult for a lot of the people that I spoke to. And some of them, I won't lie, you know, I don't want to be too much of an armchair therapist here, but I think some of them, it's really affected them their whole lives, that they had to go through that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not necessarily blaming Nickelodeon itself, but, you know, the Hollywood system itself, as we all know, can be very, very especially to younger people who might not really understand, you know, what's going on, and they have to trust, you know, parents who might be screwing them over and managers who might be screwing them over, and there's a lot that they don't understand or realize. And, you know, they wouldn't expect something like, I'm on a TV show now, all the kids at school or my neighborhood are going to make fun of me, or, you know, throw rocks at me or whatever it is, you know, right on my locker and that kind of thing, as a lot of these people had to contend with. And it was really sad to hear it. And I think it's one of the reasons why many of them, you know, grew up and didn't stay in the industry. I will say, you know, but these were also very sensitive, very smart people. You know, the majority did not stay in the business after their shows were over. And many of them became doctors, lawyers, professors. Mm-hmm. Almost everyone I spoke to no longer in the industry are, you know, are doing something that's, you know, very highly intellectual like that. And I think that also says a lot about who these kids were, and that also they were very hard workers, and, you know, did what they had to do. They had to work on the show. They had to rehearse. They had to act. They had to do all that. They had to go to all these cultural events, and then also were in school, and they were getting, mm-hmm. you know, a few of them were able to do their schooling, you know, in a trailer or whatever it is on the set, like Clerks explains it all. But many of them weren't like that. And, you know, Danny Tamborelli from Little Pete from Pete and Pete, you know, he's one of the ones obviously who's kind of stayed a little bit in the business and has remained on some shows here or there and does music and everything else. But I mean, he told me that his parents made him work at a bagel shop that was in town while he was mm-hmm. working on the show during the off seasons and whatnot, because they happened to actually shoot that show and shoot it where he lived. So, you know, these are people who were, yeah, working the actual days, you know, working, you know, after school jobs and such while they're on the show. Or Christine from You Can't See Them on Television talked about how she had to decide between staying on the show or quitting her gymnastics that she liked doing after school. And, you know, she eventually quit the gymnastics, but she told me that was a really hard decision to make. So, you know, these mm-hmm. were average, everyday kids who were not, you know, set up to be in this system as a lot of the kids are now. I mean, these days now, I'm sure you know, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, you know, the kids now, it's like sumo wrestling or something like that. You know, they're trained from a very young age. They have classes and how to talk to your fans. They have classes and how to deal with stuff on social media, how to dress, how to look, how to do this, that, and the other. There's textbooks on it. You know, it's a machine now. It's a factory now. And, you know, that's why I think a lot of the TV shows and movies now that do have kids in them just don't have that same kind of authenticity that the shows of Nickelodeon in the 80s and early 90s had, because they really were just picking kids who were just average, everyday kids. Many of whom had never done anything before and haven't done anything since, because they were just average kids. And that's, I think, was the most important factor for me when I was working on the book, and something that kept coming up, especially, as I said, since I got to know a lot of these people as adults and see them as, yeah, very normal, average people. I've had my fair share of run-ins with celebrities, both good and bad, over the years, being, you know, a pop culture historian and a journalist and everything. And again, I've mostly had good experiences, but, you know, these kids did not act like celebrities. They acted like regular people, even well into their 30s and 40s, and some of them in their 50s, so many years later. So that was very, you know, special, I think, to realize that, see that, and get to know that, and write about that.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you just said. I think just from hearing a lot of what you just said and hearing some of these things that some of these actors have said in interviews, like you said, Danny Temporelli worked at a bagel shop. I did hear that in one other interview with a guy who had been doing a little podcast called Throwback with Nickelodeon. I forget his name off the top of my head, but he did mention that, and I think it really has to do with a lot of the parenting of these kids and how they were raised. You know, they were smart, and that, you know, they instilled good values in them, and that they would not be in show business forever, and they understood that, and they, you know, so they would pick up like little jobs like that after school. And I can only imagine just how difficult it was for these kids to decide between, you know, extracurricular activities and jobs and the show they were on. It's, I mean, I could only imagine just how hard that would be. But I agree with you on the fact that I absolutely see this the same way as you, that it just seems like today so many of these kids' shows are produced so differently. I mean, what made these shows so great, and you alluded to this, is that they were regular kids, and we could connect with them. You know, they weren't, you know, superstars. They weren't, you know, famous or anything like that. They were just regular kids. And I kind of wonder how or why that changed, really, with, like, Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel. Because now you just see, I mean, it's like, it's almost like they're just too superficial and they're, like, overly talented. I mean, Nickelodeon tried to avoid that for years by trying not to go the way of the Disney Channel, and well, look where they are now. That's what they've done. It's kind of like turned into like another version of the Disney Channel. Why do you think that is? Like, what changed with how the direction of the network went in your opinion?
In my opinion, I think that it's a form of what in the business world they call mimetic isomorphism. We see this all the time. Bill Gates talks about this too in some of his early books and whatnot about business. A little different than what he's talking about, but he was talking about something called a positive spiral. And it's basically, it's the same reason that VHS took over instead of Beta, even though Beta was actually a little bit better. And, you know, even my wife, who's in the food industry, she's talked to me a lot about, a lot of people don't realize this, but Hydrox actually came out before Oreos. Everyone always thinks Hydrox is sort of generic, like crappier, like cheaper version of Oreos. It's actually the other way around. Hydrox came out before Oreos. And a lot of it, yeah. So a lot of it's like a marketing thing. And basically the idea of mimetic isomorphism is businesses are lemmings. Businesses follow other businesses. And they do what seems to be successful. Obviously, especially these days, they're more and more risk adverse. And so in my opinion, I think, and a lot of people that I spoke to, not only for this book, but over the years for other interviews and such, and just people I know in the television industry and so forth today and then, is things became very aspirational. Before, it was about the regular kid at home, you know, maybe latchkey kid. I think class was a bit of an issue too, frankly. The kids on these shows, both the characters and a lot of the actors, were not from wealthy families. They didn't live in these mansions in the sky. They didn't live in these palaces, beautiful houses, as pretty much all the kids on all the shows and movies do now. You know, so I think that the class issue was a bit of a thing there. They were just regular, you know, average kids. And
right.
And then all of a sudden, shows like Hannah Montana come out, and shows where the kids are wizards and warlocks and witches, and shows where they're rock stars start coming out. I think Hannah Montana had a lot to do with it. Suddenly it became this cottage industry of making shows about who were living the fantasy life of the regular kids. So it's almost like stage one was let's show the kids other kids that are like them. stage two becomes, okay, we've got them in on the show. Nickelodeon is the kids network now. Now let's take it up a notch. And also to try to compete with Disney, we need to start doing more stuff like Hannah Montana. And again, I think this goes back to a lot of what we're talking about. Not only is it aspirational, so it's not who you are, who I am, it's who, you know, we quote unquote want to be. You know, we want to be a rock star. We want to be, but also again, both Miley Cyrus herself obviously came from an extremely privileged background. Her family was in the industry, so the actress herself is very pretty, she's very wealthy, comes from this famous background. And then the character on the show, again, they make her look really stylish, they make the whole show look really slick. She's this like superstar, and it works, and it goes really, really well. I mean, Miley Cyrus obviously is still working today in a big way, and people still talk about Hannah Montana and this, that, and the other. And you know, Nickelodeon that time is going through a lot of transitions when Jerry Laybourne and her original team left to go do other things, and when the new people came into Nickelodeon, they really wanted to push. You know, it was their choice, and it certainly worked. But they wanted to make Nickelodeon this global billion-dollar brand and do more with merchandising and these award shows and all the other things that came. And of course, what they're going to do is, again, it goes back to mimetic isomorphism. What's being successful elsewhere? Let's look at our competition, Disney. What are they doing? Hannah Montana. Okay, what are they doing? They're doing shows about wizards and witches and things about kids who are special, kids who have these superpowers or whatever it is. And so Nickelodeon just followed suit, as a lot of people did. And I think we're seeing that more and more today. And I think that it's also related to, you know, what we see a lot on social media and what a lot of people are saying, especially for younger people, why social media can be really bad for them psychologically, because they're constantly looking at what celebrities are doing, or they're constantly looking at what their friends seem to be doing. Look how good they are. Look how happy they are. Look at all the fun they're having in their pictures. Look at all these vacations they get to go on. Look at them, you know, opening up these boxes of toys that they're talking about and all this stuff. And it makes a lot of these younger people in particular, who are very impressionable, feel less than, feel inferior to. And, you know, and so on one level, they're feeling bad about it, but on another level, they can't help but want to watch it and see it, because maybe they'll learn how to do that too. You know, maybe they'll learn how to become the next Disney superstar. Maybe they'll learn how to become like a rock star or whatever it is. And they want to look like that. They want to act like that. They want to be like that. So whereas before we were seeing ourselves, now we're seeing this like kind of slick, glossier version of ourselves, or the kids are. And, you know, I think it really is a shame. And, you know, I don't want to get too much soapbox here, as I already am stepping up a little bit. But, you know, I think it has a lot to do with why there is a lot of depression and a lot of sadness and a lot of problems that a lot of kids are having today, especially ones who are in their teens or tweens or whatever, because a lot of this stuff. And I think it's really unfortunate. They don't have TV shows or movies really as much anymore showing them people like themselves. I can't think of any TV show, even on all the streaming services, that show a working class family anymore. I mean, that's just completely gone.
You're right.
Every show out there in a mansion, big house. They have their parents are doctors or lawyers. They almost all take place in, you know, a swanky part of New York City or a swanky part of LA. It's like there's no way to kind of see, you know, yourself as a regular person, as a regular kid with, you know, your parents are divorced, you're living in a small apartment or whatever it is. Those shows don't exist anymore, and I don't really see too many movies like that out there anymore either, for kids or adults, frankly. So, you know, I think that it's a big problem, honestly.
You're right, and it's a shame that it's become that. It's interesting hearing your theory on that once they drew kids in with shows about regular kids, it just doesn't make any sense why the Disney Channel would go away from that to come up with, you know, superstar kids that, like you said, inspire others to do better. It's like, you know, you figure, like, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Just keep doing what worked. But yet, for some reason, it's like, I guess maybe it had to do with society or you know, management decisions. But as time changed, you know...
It's the economic system, too. I'm sorry to interrupt, John, but I just have to throw it there. Especially Disney. Part of what
money,
we were saying, and this is what was happening in the 80s and early 90s anyway, there was actually a lot going on. Again, I don't want to get too specific or academic here, but there was a lot going on, as I'm sure you know, and some of your listeners, with changes to things, to policies through the FCC and policies through the way that entertainment companies and media companies were being regulated or not regulated any longer. I would honestly suggest anyone who's truly interested in this kind of stuff to look into Bill Clinton's telecommunications bill of 1996. I think that that was one of the more harmful, devastating policies that he passed. And really, it was responsible for deregulating a lot of the media and entertainment industry in ways that they couldn't do certain things that they were able to do later. And that includes now they could own and produce and distribute things in a much more streamlined way. There's a lot more vertical integration. So what Disney was starting to do is packaging everything. So they can make a show like Hannah Montana, and then they're creating this icon, Hannah Montana / Miley Cyrus, who can also sell albums, who can go on tours, they can sell the merchandising. So it's all included together. I mean, now that's almost what happens with any child star, is they're going to be in a movie, they're going to be on a TV show, there's going to be maybe a documentary or something about them. Someone like me will write a book about them or for them or whatever. They'll be doing all this stuff on social media. They, of course, end up becoming a singer in a band or whatever it is. And, you know, they're doing all these different things because a lot of that was just the economic policy of the country and the world changed a lot of ways. And even the way that television media and entertainment was regulated or not changed a lot. So they were able to do all these different things with vertical integration. So that was all a big part of it, too. I mean, as you probably have seen in the book, and another thing I'm really proud of that I talked about that Nickelodeon did was they were really not about merchandising until much later down the road. Casio very famously offered Double Dare the ability to, they were going to give them $1 million if they just put the Casio name under the Double Dare clock. And Jerry Laybourne and they said no. And they really needed that money back then. $1 million back then was like almost, you know, probably $5 million today, you know, the early mid-80s. And, you know, they were struggling. They needed that money. But Jerry Laybourne said no. And, you know, there really wasn't much merchandising done. There was the, you know, you can't do that on television, slime shampoo, and there was some cereal stuff and things like that. But for the most part, it really didn't get big with the merchandising and the like until, you know, the mid-90s when a lot of the people who created, you know, the classic Nickelodeon had already left. And so that floodgate opened. And, you know, to their credit, good for them, Herb Scannell and Albie Hecht and a lot of the people who ran Nickelodeon after Jerry left, you know, they succeeded. They wanted to make this $1 billion, you know, corporation globally, and they did it. And, you know, good for them. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it affected, you know, these shows and such. And to have a show about, you know, a couple of scroungy, acne-faced, you know, braces-wearing kids at a summer camp or whatever it is doesn't really lead to concerts, doesn't really lead to a lot of merchandising, doesn't, right. You know, aside from T-shirts or something. So really it became about the business itself changing, and you know there were political things involved, as I said, and you know it's something that, you know, I was glad I can get in there a little bit in this book and some of the articles and things I've written about, but you know I think that it's time for other people to really get into that more and to look into the why that was going on, because I think it's really affecting how media, entertainment, television, even for something as simple as just kids, is really affecting our society right now, where this really came from. So, you know, again, I'll get back off my soapbox now, but I do think that these things are important. And it's not just, you know, goofy kids shows. There's some stuff going on behind the scenes that I revealed. And, you know, I was talking to the people who really made a lot of this happen. There was actually a couple chapters of the book that did not end up in the book where I spoke much more specific, or had the interviews much more specifically talked about a lot of this stuff. And we took it out, frankly, because of word count issues. You know, I had a certain amount of words I was able to use. And I just thought, you know, I don't want to drag the book down with stuff about economics and politics and certain things like that about what was going on with policy changes, the FCC and such. Interesting stuff, but it just, when I had to cut some things out, that was what I cut out. But I had chapters where we talked about this, and at some point, maybe later down the road, maybe I'll do something with those that really talked about how the network itself changed and some of the business things going on behind the scenes. You know, the book is more about like the actors, and I wanted to keep it more fun. And but you know, now that we're all a little bit older, I think we can take it, read, and say, wow, this kind of stuff was going on in the background too. You know, at the same time.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that would be good to include in like if you ever do like another revised edition. After this one, maybe you can include those in there as well if you think people can handle it.
Yeah, I mean, truth be told, that's kind of what I was hoping for this one. You know, I'm very proud of the 5th anniversary edition that came out, I think, in April now. And, you know, I was able to make a couple of quick little changes that were needed. But, you know, and Phil's fantastic introduction, I'm really appreciative of that. Truth be told, it's not, you know, I'm probably shooting myself in the foot here. It's not that different from the original. And unfortunately, the reason why is, again, goes back to some of the business stuff we're talking about. I mean, the publishing world, I don't have to go into this too much, but, you know, it's struggling too. There's less and less people buying books, and, you know, it's tough. And even when you're working with a big company like Penguin Random House, I am so grateful and thankful that they worked with me on this, because not every book gets to do that. And even a lot of my, you know, former editors and some of my friends in the publishing industry, some of my agents and all those kind of folks, other author friends that have, they were all really surprised that Penguin was doing this, because it's just not something that gets done very often anymore. So clearly this book has a special place even in the realm of Penguin Random House itself. So I'm so thankful they did it, but we just didn't have the resources, and they didn't want to invest the money and the time into allowing me to make some of those bigger changes. And I would have liked to have put in those two other chapters or something, but that would have affected printing costs and distribution costs, and, you know, it is an economic thing now. So it's great that they let me do it at all, but, you know, I wanted to put those in. So I'll say it like this. I wouldn't hold my breath, and maybe I'll just figure out some other way of doing it. I've talked with a few people over the years, editors of different magazines or online blogs or whatever, obviously, about maybe running some of it there. And some of the stuff that I did not have room for in the book, my good friend, who you might also know of, Cassine Gaines, who's written books on Back to the Future and Christmas Story, just did a Dark Crystal one that was great. He and I worked together for a website called Decider, which the New York Post owns, and we took some of my material that was not in the book about Nicktoons, and did this really great kind of full-on Nicktoons oral history. It was a series of three or four articles, I can't remember which, now that Cassine and I worked on. I basically just sent him all of the stuff that I had, and he kind of helped me to clean it up and work with him on that. And so we did that. So if anyone's interested, I think that came out in 2016 or maybe 15, but it was about three or four articles. And it was literally just interviews from Slime that I didn't use for the book, but all that focused on the Nicktoons. And so, you know, that was fun doing something like that. Maybe we'll do something similar with this other stuff. Who knows?
Yeah, and it's probably best that you didn't include that in the original Slime book, because like you said, it would have taken the fun out of it. It would have, you know, gone in the way of some of the more, because it was meant to be presented as a positive book, so probably it might have gone a little too deep, and maybe people wouldn't have been able to handle it. It's like, one minute you're reading, oh, this is a nice story about someone, next thing you know, the economics about Nickelodeon, stay tuned tonight at 11, you know, it would have kind of changed the tone a little bit, you know. So it's probably good that you kind of left that out, but yeah, that's great that you put that up on that blog with your friend there. That's terrific. I mean, you know, people are creating blogs and podcasts like what I do about things they're interested in. So there's definitely a place for it in our society with media. So there are other alternatives for sure.
Sure. Yeah. So we'll see what happens. You know, I'll say this though, who knows what'll happen next, but I have a feeling this is going to be the last edition of the book. One of the reasons I did it was because it was also the 40th anniversary in Nickelodeon, this past year.
That's
great.
Right.
And, you know, again, truth, and we thought maybe there'd be a lot more attention because of that. Truth be told, the 40th anniversary came and went. No one really said much about it. Phil Moore himself was trying to maybe get something going with Nickelodeon because he's back to doing some projects for them again, and has been meeting with Brian and that kind of thing about this. And, you know, the reality is, I mean, anyone can look it up. I'm sure on some of the, like, smaller, you know, kind of personal blogs or whatever, there was some stuff. But, you know, none of the mainstream media outlets really talked. There was a little thing in the Hollywood Reporter that barely mentioned it, and I think that was about it. So, you know, the sad thing is, and why I'm glad that the book's out there, and while you know, there are still people doing interviews like what you're doing here, I think that renaissance that we saw, yes, there's some of these other reboots coming out and some other exciting things happening in the world of Nickelodeon nostalgia, but it just feels to me and some of my other friends who have done this kind of work also that it's sort of starting to peter out. You know, it had its rise. The book came out, there were all these events, there were a few other books that came out, some of these other documentaries and such, but the fact that the 40th anniversary of Nickelodeon came and went, no one really said anything about it. And there's also been, as you might have seen, some anniversaries of some of these other shows, the Alex Mack, Secret World of Alex Mack, Nick Arcade even, and a few others that sort of went, and Nickelodeon didn't really do anything with it, and there weren't really any big articles about it or anything like that. And, you know, so, you know, we'll see what, I mean, that Legends of the Hidden Temple movie came out, and, you know, it sort of came and went, and, you know, some of these other reboots have sort of come and gone, and some of these events. So, you know, it's cycle might have gone past, and you know, that's sad, but I'm glad that there's a book like Slimed out there where people can kind of revisit it and learn some of these things. And I'll tell you, John, some of my favorite messages that I get, some of my favorite emails that people send me still to this day are younger people, 14, 15, from all over the world. And they all say the same thing. They go, thank you for writing this book. You know, my older brother had it, or my uncle had it, or my aunt, or whatever it is. And, you know, they used to tell me about watching these shows when they were my age. And I never heard of these shows before. I just saw people saying, like, wow, I had no idea there was something like Are You Afraid of the Dark or Ren and Stimpy or Doug or whatever it is. It's just people writing me and saying, thank you for introducing me, not reintroducing, but thank you for introducing me to these shows that I never heard of. And you know what's funny, John? They say the same thing we did. I mean, a few of them literally will say, there's nothing on TV like this anymore. Like, I'm so glad that I can go back and watch these things and that I know about them now because, you know, there's nothing on for me. And I'm glad that I can watch some, you know, Salute Your Shorts or You Can't Do That on Television or whatever it is. And so those are some of my favorite emails. And just to say, yeah, clearly the next generation coming up is just as interested in this stuff if they have a chance to know about it and see it. As we are, having watched it when we were growing up. And I think that that's really exciting. I dated a younger girl for a little while before I met my wife. She was about 10 years younger than I. You know, it was a short relationship. We met kind of randomly and started dating each other. And one of the things we did was, it was a couple years ago when they put Wonder Years on Netflix for the first time.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah, one of the things that we did together was we'd get together, hang out on the couch, and watch a bunch of Wonder Years. We were basically binge-watching Wonder Years. And for me, it was really cool to see the show again, you know, for the first time in a very long time. But for her, it was fun, too, because she had never seen them at all before. And it was really kind of cool to watch it with a younger person who was seeing it for the first time. And, you know, she was the same way. She was like, I can't believe there's no shows like this anymore, and this is so amazing, and look at the way it's shot, and the acting, and yeah, these people kind of look and talk like regular people, and all this, and just how special it was for her. So it was really cool kind of watching it through her eyes, a younger person who'd never seen one before.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you received email from younger people that did not grow up watching these shows. I would have figured it would have been the opposite. You would have got email from older people that remembered these shows and said, you know, thank you for reminding me of my childhood, when in reality it's people that didn't grow up with it that were introduced to it by either their friends or family. So that's really special. That must have been really touching to hear that.
Yeah, and I do get my emails from people our age or even older or whatever it is as well. You know, what's nice about that, I'll say, I haven't really talked about this before, and I don't want to get into it too much, but a couple of them have, I've gotten emails from people who told me that they've been having some hard times or that they maybe had a rough childhood, and that these shows were really important to them growing up, when they might have had, you know, an abusive household. Like, some people have kind of really opened up to me in some of these emails. And one gentleman actually told me that he's really going through a very difficult time right now, and that his therapist said he should reach out to 5 people that he admires. And even if he doesn't hear back, it just was sort of an exercise that his therapist suggested. And he sent me a little bit of information about himself. He told me about what his therapist had said, and he told me how much he enjoyed it. And, you know, that it reminded him of his childhood and this, that, and the other. And, you know, he just said, you know, I'm not asking for anything. I don't expect you to respond. I just, you know, doing this because my therapist suggested it. And I just want to thank you for, you know, bringing a little bit of light in my life with this book. And, you know, I emailed him back through some tough times myself at that moment, just that morning, in fact. And I kind of opened up, too, and said, you know, I'm going through some tough times myself. And just to get an email like this really means a lot. Because, you know, John, I'll tell you, it's been a long time since the book came out. It's been an even longer time since I started. I mean, really, I think I started in earnest really putting stuff together as early as 2011, maybe even a little earlier than that, at least, you know, really thinking about it. Such, like I said, I had it in my mind as early as 2007, 2008. So this has been, you know, big, big part of my life. And I've met people through it, and I've traveled around the country with it. And, you know, the book itself, just like with Phil, the book really, obviously, greatly influenced my life, who I am as a person, as a man, as a writer, as an adult, and it's, you know, it's had this profound influence on me, and I don't get to hear people say stuff like that. I worked extremely hard on it, you know, it was very difficult just tracking people down, setting up the interviews, and blah, blah, blah. And I don't want to turn this into a whole a woe is me thing because I'm really happy with how it all worked out. But it's rare, you know, to hear people say, hey, I really appreciated the work you did. Hey, this is a good book. And you know what? It's nice when I get it. And the other thing is it's really taught me, and I've always kind of been like this anyway, but I try to return the favor. So I've actually reached out to authors that I like when they write a book. And a couple of them, I read one recently that I recommend to everybody by a guy named John Cook, C-O-O-K-E, called Weirdo. It's about the Weirdo magazine, comic book magazine that Robert Crumb and Aileen Crumb and Peter Bagg edited throughout the 80s. And really interesting comic book series, underground stuff. A lot of people like Daniel Klaus, who did Ghost World, and others were involved in it as well, Art Spiegelman of Mouse. And you know, someone did, this guy John Cook, did this amazing job of putting together a full history of Weirdo. And he'd been working on it for 10 or 15 years, and it's got so much information in it. And the amount of work that he did is just insane, and I'm sure he didn't get very much money for it, for the advance or whatever. I'm sure he's not going to get a lot of royalties because it's not the kind of book that sells millions or whatnot. And I emailed him, and I just said, you know, I didn't tell him who I was. I didn't say from one author to another, blah, blah, blah. I just said, you know, I really appreciate that you did this, and thank you for putting the work and time into it. I'm sure it was. And he emailed me back and thanked me. And, you know, it's just, so I try to pay it forward and tell people that whose books I really like, especially when I could tell they put a lot of time and energy and work into it and probably didn't get
financially. And you should be really proud of yourself that you did write this book. I mean, you really connected with a lot of Nickelodeon fans, and including myself. I mean, you know, I think when you're old and gray and you look back on this, I think you should really, you know, take a look back and say that, you know, wow, I really, you know, did something really significant, and it got a lot of positive attention and feedback from people.
I appreciate that, and I know that, you know, I don't want to be sitting here crying in my oatmeal here, but look, when you're an actor or something like that, you're out in front of this, you're out on the screen, people are seeing you, people are talking about you, people want to, you know, write about your dog or whatever it is, or some vacation you just took, or some new dress that you bought, or whatever it is, and that's fine, that's what that world is about. But when you're a writer or a producer or something like I am, and a lot of my friends are, you know, people don't really see us, they don't really know, you know, who's behind stuff. You know, most people wouldn't even know that, you know, that the 92nd Y event, for example, like, I pretty much put that entire thing together myself, including a lot of wheeling and dealing and negotiations with companies that were providing all the live musical equipment and getting everybody into town. And I mean, that took almost 6 months to put that entire thing together while I was working a full-time job and stuff with the book itself. You know, and it was tough, but I'm really glad that I can see it online, that people still talk about it, that it brought a lot of people together. But yeah, you know, people thought, you know, Mark Summers produced it or put it together, that the 92nd Y put it together, or Penguin put it together. Really, it was me. I mean, I really put that together as I did most of the other events. And I only say that because, again, I just want the credit to go where credit's due, not just for me, but for other friends of mine that I know do similar kinds of things. No one ever expects that the writer is doing a lot of stuff. But I can tell you right now, John, that we have to pretty much be a one-man band these days. I mean, every one of my writer friends, no matter how big or small, they have to set up all their own events. They have to get everything in order. There's a lot of stuff that you would think that when you're working with a company, they would handle. You know, Penguin paid for a lot of events and such, and I'm really grateful for them for doing that. And the 92nd Y people were really great in helping to put it together. But I know that when a lot of my friends are doing these things, you know, you have to do everything yourself. And that even goes down to, like, the transcriptions for the interviews and all this other stuff. So it's a very difficult process. And I think it's unfortunately why so few people who, again, are just average people who don't have a lot of money, who don't have a lot of connections, aren't really writing books anymore either, or getting as involved in media or entertainment. You know, they just can't afford it. And, you know, it's getting more and more difficult for regular people like myself. I call myself a working class artist or working class writer to keep doing this, because you're working on some book proposal for 6 months or a year. You're interviewing people, you're talking to people, you're putting this thing together, and you might not even sell it. And, you know, meanwhile, you're working two or three other jobs, you're working a full-time job or whatever it is, and you can't really afford to travel to go meet these people and so forth. And then there are people who, you know, are living in their Brooklyn apartment that their parents or their grandparents or whatever are paying for, even well into their 30s and 40s maybe. And, you know, they're able to do those things. They're able to make that happen. And, you know, it's good for them, but that disallows the regular folks who can't really afford to do that because we have freaking you're making money, you know. So it's just tough. Again, I don't want to soapbox yet again, but I just think that this is an important thing. I see this happen with a lot of my friends that are writers and filmmakers and such. Just people are dropping out because they can't afford it anymore, you know.
Right. I can relate to this personally, just in my own sense. I mean, I'm not a writer. I mean, I'm more of like a broadcaster. But I mean, what I do with my podcast, I put this whole thing together myself. I can totally relate to what you're saying. I mean, I've gone through my own share of trials and tribulations and adversity in my personal life within the last 5 or 6 years prior to now. And everything that I did to get to where I am today, nobody gave to me. Nobody just presented an opportunity to me. I had to work for it. I had to earn everything I got. I mean, I had to single-handedly get back to school. I won't go into the whole thing here on the air, but I'll just say that I was struggling for a bit. My personal life was in bad shape. My parents and I were forced to have to move into an apartment where we live now, and I had to find a part-time job to save up enough money to get back to school, earn my bachelor's degree in communications. And that whole time,
sure,
I also had to find things that I was interested in that would look good on my resume. Like what I do now is I volunteer at a public access television station. I produce a sports talk show. I got the opportunity to host a podcast like this. I mean, I had to single-handedly do all that myself and focus on work and school at one point as I was finishing up. So I can totally relate to what you're saying. I mean, I am by no means a celebrity myself. I mean, I am a sort of a working class average Joe with a lot of talent, passion for what I love, and it's so nice to know that you have the same thing. So I can definitely understand that and connect with people like that very well.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's really important for us to talk about this. I mean, sometimes you feel a little, you know, maybe you're sounding arrogant or whatever it is, but I think for that reason that you just said, when we talk about these things, it gets other people to say, hey, I feel the same way, or I want to talk about this too. And it's important that we're discussing this because, really, again, I don't want to get into too much of a soapbox of thing, but it is a class issue and something that doesn't really get talked about very often because, frankly, the people who get to talk about things are from a higher class. So, of course, they're not going to talk about this.
Right.
So, you know, it is important, though, that we discuss these things and that people are made aware of what's going on so that hopefully it can change. I had a friend who's also a pop culture historian and an author who writes about, you know, Disney and these different kinds of things. And I actually stayed with him for a night when I was in New York recently, as I mentioned. And somehow something about how much he got for his advance for his last book or mine or something came up. And I actually said something like, oh, you know, we probably shouldn't, you know, be talking about this. I'm sorry if it's making you uncomfortable. And he went, no, we definitely need to talk about this. This is so important that we talk about it. You know, people really need, you know, it should be a social taboo to discuss how much money you're making or whatever it is, you know, not to push in people's face, but so that we all know how hard it's been lately, especially for other fellow writers and such. I mean, you know,
right,
any business you work for, one of the things that often they tell you is, you know, don't discuss your salary with the other employees. But if you're not doing that, how can you know if there's things going on like wage discrepancies where someone's getting paid less than someone else for wrong reasons? Or how are you going to know that maybe we need to do something with the union because, you know, people aren't getting paid enough or whatever it might be? And, you know, that's, and my friend was telling me about this, and I realized you're 100% right. You know, it is important that we talk about this. And that people are aware that there's something really unfortunate going on in the media and entertainment worlds where the only people who can really invest their time and energy into it to make things happen are people from an upper crust part of the class society. And that's really unfortunate. It's unfortunate for us who are trying to do our own thing still, but it's also unfortunate for the consumers because how boring is that they're getting all these TV shows and movies from these people that all went to these, you know, private schools in New York and private schools in LA and a lot of them know each other and you know, they're coming from a very different mindset than the rest of us.
Right.
Know, and
yeah,
I think that's an important point to make, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, we were mentioning that earlier and I was about to say, I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a little bit of pride in what you do. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, being proud of yourself and understand, having a good amount of self-awareness and understanding where you came from to get to where you are now. And I think that's something a lot of famous people forget is, you know, they think of where they are now instead of the path they took to get to where they are. And
right.
that's part of what's so unfortunate is because they don't have a sense of humility like maybe like people like you and I might. They tend to get so caught up in, you know, in the fact that they're famous and where they are now instead of what it took to get to where they're at. And
I
think that adds to how unfortunate our society is that, you know, the upper class people lack that sense of, you know, of humility and they kind of forget how much hard work that they put into to get to where they are now. They just kind of take for granted
what they have. A lot of them, you know, like, didn't have to work as hard. You know what I mean? And
right. They just had it easy. You know?
Yeah. We don't need to name names again, but you know, there's definitely a few people out there who, you know, have some movies or TV shows or whatever, and you could see in the work that they're producing. They just have a very different perspective on the world and society than a lot of other people do because they never really had to worry about certain things because they were always growing up in these very elegant, nice, you know, homes in New York or LA or whatever, and got to go to Europe over the summers while the rest of us were working, you know, jobs over the summer or whatever. You know, there's just certain people working who I kind of guarantee you they've never had to wait on a phone call for 3 hours to deal with a tax problem or unemployment or whatever it is. And, you know, good for them. That's fine. But, you know, those kinds of things need to be seen and talked about in movies and TV shows, too. And certainly in journalism, because, you know, there are problems with things like unemployment. There's problems with things like, you know, some of the other issues that, you know, working class and middle class people have to deal with that the upper crust folks don't really have to deal with because they've got assistants to do it for them, or, you know, they always had, you know, family who took care of those kinds of things. I read an interview recently with one of these folks, you know, very, very unaware of themselves. And she was going through, you know, an addiction to opioids and came out and was talking about it and all this stuff. And, you know, at a point she explains, you know, she moved back in with her parents, you know, she's in her 30s. This is a successful person who already has a lot of money of her own anyway. But, you know, she moves back into her parents' very, you know, nice New York apartment or whatever it is and talking about that. And it's like, hey, you know what? Not everybody gets to do that. Not everybody has that as an option. You know, there are people who are dealing with opioid issues or other issues, and they don't have, you know, a nice penthouse apartment to go to fall back on.
It
creates a different kind of stuff when you're making TV shows or writing books or doing journalism, when your perspective is different from everybody else's. You know?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I just realized as you said that one of my friends has actually gotten into acting within the past year. And one of the things he was considering he's done a lot of acting and been in extras in TV shows and movies. And one of the things he was actually almost considering being an extra in was a movie about the opioid crisis, actually. The director's message was that he wanted to convey to people, I think, what you just said, and that, you know, life is not perfect, and that light needs to be brought to people who are struggling or middle class people.
Right.
So I think there is a small part of, I mean, a very, very small part of media that does want to address this, but it's unfortunate that there is not enough producers and directors out there that go for that. They want the high end, you know, fancy, glossy type of lifestyle that people can't relate to. It's kind of unfortunate.
You know, to wrap it all up, I mean, that really goes back to Disney versus Nickelodeon in the 80s and early 90s. You know, Nickelodeon for us was, you know, a little bit more punk rock, a little bit more DIY, a little bit more grungy and gritty and very real to the vast majority of Americans watching, and people from other countries too when it started going, you know, international. Whereas Disney was, you know, glossy and slick. And, you know, even when you watch the old Mickey Mouse Club, not just the newer one with Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake and all those folks, but even the old one, it's like, you know, those were happy-go-lucky kids who, you know, were probably taught how to smile like that. And they were all very good looking and they were all primed and permed and the whole thing. So, I mean, Disney was always like that. And, you know, good for them. It worked for them. It made them, you know, the huge business that they are today. But it's just nice that there was, for about, you know, 7 or 8 years, this period of time when Nickelodeon existed for the rest of us. And, you know, it's funny, as you probably know, we talk about in the book, you know, it was a lot of the same people who did early MTV, and early MTV was the same way. You watch some of those really, really early shows. I mean, Andy Warhol even had a show on, you know, more or less. And, you know, you'd have people like the Ramones and others on there, and, I mean, it was not glossy at all. It was not slick at all. And some of the other really early shows and certainly the music videos, it was a bunch of, you know, regular Joes who, you know, were getting, you know, whatever money they could together and throwing it up there. And yeah, there was the big production stuff too, Thriller and so forth, obviously. But the earliest days of MTV, made by a lot of the same people who did Nickelodeon, there was this sense of, you know, just entertainment and media for the rest of us, and something that was, you know, a little grungier, a little more DIY. And it's really fun to watch some of those early shows, like at the, right, you know, television museum and that kind of thing. Or I'm sure a lot of that stuff's on YouTube now.
Yes.
But, you know, it's that was the difference. And we're seeing that now is the Disney side of things really has taken over. And you're right. And, you know, people talk about that even in the book, that Nickelodeon became just another Disney. It went from being anti-Disney to another Disney.
Right.
You know, it's a cycle that I think we're seeing in a lot of things now, whether it's the media or whatever, where it's the, you know, we've talked about it enough, but I think you get my point here. So it's interesting to see how something as simple as early Nickelodeon in a book like this could, you know, for some of us have a little bit more implications about what's going on in society at large. And rightly so, because a lot of the people who are making the movies and the TV and who are journalists and who are running a lot of these businesses, even in Silicon Valley or whatever it is, they are people our age who grew up in shows. So, of course, it's going to impact who they are as people today and how they're going to run their business. And I would love to talk to Mark Zuckerberg about what he thinks about You Can't Be Done on Television or Sleep Your Shorts. He probably has, you know, he probably watched them like the rest of us and might, you know, have some interesting things to say about that, you know. So, you know, it makes sense that this stuff would have had the impact it had because, you know, it's 30 years later and here we are now, so.
Yeah, so we're talking here with Matthew Klickstein, author of The Slime Book. We've been running for about an hour here. We haven't had any commercials, so we'll take our first break here. We'll come back and we'll talk more Nickelodeon and his Slime Book in just a minute. Stay tuned.
MVMT is the affordable brand for men's and women's watches. Go to MVMTwatches.com and browse through the bestseller collection, all of the watches, sunglasses, wristband straps, and watch-related accessories. It's not surprising that MVMT offers free shipping worldwide to their customers. Sign up for the newsletter at MVMTwatches.com, read the MVMT brand story, and get caught up on the brand. Premium design at a fair price.
We are back with John Meiser and Matthew Klickstein here with us here this week. I've been going on for a while about a lot of different things. We kind of got off the rails a bit, but we'll get back on track here right now. It's perfectly okay. So, Matt, I wanted to ask you, you kind of alluded to this earlier about the Nickelodeon revivals. You kind of started to get into that a little bit before we went off in a bunch of different directions. I wanted to ask you this. You know, we've seen so many revivals on Nickelodeon within the last couple of years, and a lot of revivals in, you know, in entertainment and pop culture. My thoughts on that are that, in my opinion, I think producers and directors want to go with what works, what people are already familiar with. And it's a combination of that and maybe the fact that some people don't have a lot of creativity and might be a bit lazy when it comes to new ideas. I was curious as to what your thoughts were on all these, on everything being revived. And not just Nickelodeon, but pop culture in general.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on just revivals and so many things coming back?
Well, like I think a lot of people, I'm ambivalent about it. Obviously, you know, it can be fun sometimes to see an updated version of a film or TV show. You know, I sometimes like cover songs better than the originals. I think Fiona Apple does an amazing job of Across the Universe. And I kind of like it even better than the original, frankly, but I'm a big Fiona Apple fan. So, you know, sometimes these reboots or revivals can be really good. I like the original Village of the Dam, but I also like the new Village of the Dam, which is not that new anymore, but the one that John Carpenter made, I think, in the early 90s. So, you know, it can work. I mean, I know that there's a lot of, you know, especially in the fanboy and fangirl community, a lot of, you know, umbrage about reboots and, you know, the original versus the new and such. There are times where those reboots or revivals can work. But yeah, I agree with you 100%, and it's true. I mean, there's no question that part of it is a certain lack of, I don't know if I would say a certain lack of creativity or ingenuity, but I do agree that I think it's a bit of laziness. You know, all these producers and such now have so many things that they're working on constantly. They have so much on their plate, and, you know, they're not able to give the full attention that's needed to a lot of the projects that they're working on, because they're working on so many different things, because everything now is about quantity over quality. It's the shotgun effect. Let's throw out a million different things and hopefully one of them takes off. I mean, there are whole companies that are very transparent about that is their mission. That's their process. And you certainly see this with a lot of the streaming services. You know, Netflix buys everything and puts all of it up, and you know, those few big hits that work, you know, they get excited about it. Amazon does the same thing. And there's no secret about this. Everyone knows this is how they operate. You know, and the good news is they are buying a lot of stuff, so you might be able to sell your movie or documentary or something to them. The not-so-good news is it still might not get promoted at all, and it might get buried under the other 100 things that get released that week and so forth. So it has its ups and its downs. There's a term that you might be aware of, and it's important to remember, unaided awareness. Unaided awareness is the marketing term that's really responsible for all this. We deal with it a lot in publishing as well. When I'm pitching a book or something, this comes up often. And it's related to something else called personal branding, which Morgan Spurlock, the guy who did Supersize Me, talks a lot about in a great film he made a few years ago called The Greatest Story Ever Sold, where he actually made an entire documentary about product placement and, in fact, used product placement in the film that he was, like, talking about. It was actually a very interesting movie. So personal branding is that idea of you, John, are something of a brand. You know, you are able to sell your podcast, you're able to sell your show, you're able to promote yourself and everything because of who you are. You're sort of the celebrity of your little company that is your podcast, your show, right, whatever it might be. So you can, it's just like bringing around a resume. You can maybe go and try to sell a book or try to sell, you know, some other show or something because of who you are and the branding power you have for your show that you have there, just as I would maybe be able to try to use that. And I certainly have to my advantage, as we all must these days. And, you know, I'm not just Matthew Klickstein. I'm Matthew Klickstein, author of Slimes and co-author of Screenflow Confidential about The Simpsons and blah, 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 blah. So that's personal branding. And that can be very important on a superficial level to people buying things because they might not care as much about your product, but they care a lot about who you are as a brand because they know, okay, a bunch of people will buy whatever book is next because you're the guy who did Slimes. Or a bunch of people will listen to your next podcast show, John, because you're the guy who did this other successful podcast show. So it's an easier bet. And they might, again, I know this is the case. They might not even necessarily care what your new show is. They just know that you're going to bring with you a bunch of followers and a bunch of people that are already fans of yours. In the comedy world, they actually call it bringers. Their bookers will book a comedian, even if they don't think they're really funny, because they're bringing an audience, because maybe they're very popular on social media or whatever it might be. And then unaided awareness is basically the same kind of thing. So when a producer is going and pitching something to his boss or her boss and says, I have this great idea for a new project, that person's probably going to have a little bit more success getting something going if he or she says, I want to do a new version of such and such, and I could show you all the paperwork and all the numbers and all the statistics that show that no matter what we do, this will bring a lot of fans and a lot of people want to see it, to see this new version of it. And they're well aware that a lot of people are going to go and see it to hate watch it. That's actually part of the demographics now. It really is. A lot of these companies are purposely making some of these things, not just to have people come out to see it who want to see it to enjoy it, but also they know that there's enough fanboys and fangirls who go and hate watch things now. And that's actually part of the demographic choices they're making now when they're doing these things. So that's unaided awareness. And again, it really comes down to the brand and to the followers and the audience that's already there. And you know what? If the show or movie doesn't work out, the producer can say, hey, don't blame me. I showed you all the statistics and everything that said that this should have been a hit, that we should have been able to bring in a lot of people. So even if it doesn't do well, they're able to leverage, hey, you know, the first one did really well, so the sequel should have done really well too. You know, that it's not my fault. So it's a way for them to sort of pass the buck if the thing doesn't work out either. So, yeah, it's like anything else these days. It's a lot about marketing, and it's a lot about branding power. And, you know, sometimes that works when you have someone who really is great, and you're excited to see his or her next movie or read his or her next book, and you know it's probably going to be really good because you've liked their other stuff, or like a band who you know, want to see, you know, or them in concert or whatever it is, and that's fine, you know. But the bad news is if you're not somebody who has, you know, high branding power, or that unaided awareness, or a lot of followers in social media say, or whatever it is, whatever metric they're using to decide what to buy next, you know, you might have a really great book, or a really great song, or a really great idea for a movie, or maybe even made a really great movie with some of your friends, or whatever it is, cheaply, but you might not ever even be able to get into the room to try to sell it, because, you know, who are you? You're nobody. You know, who's your audience? You don't have one. And that's unfortunate, because then we miss out on some of those again, unique stories and things that are made by people who are busy making things rather than, you know, getting a lot of followers on social media or whatever it is, or going to all these events and making themselves famous. You know, there are people who are more introverted and aren't interested in that kind of thing. So we're losing out on those stories and such also. So, and I think that it's also related to what we were talking about before about who's getting to make movies and TV shows and be in journalism and stuff these days versus, you know, how things were before. You know, branding was such an issue. So,
boy, this is the easiest show I've ever done. I haven't had to say much this week.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a talker, that's for sure.
Yeah, you could definitely have your own talk show at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. If someone wants to pay me, I'd be happy to do it. But
yeah, right. Yeah, that's not how this works, unfortunately. But,
no, yeah, I'm well aware.
No, you're absolutely right. It's like, it seems like if you have your own, you know, fan club or your own niche, it's like those people just want they want more. They want everything you're throwing at them. That's the case with me and with not just with this podcasting, but my brother is involved with local politics, and he's let that get to his head to the point where he thinks he's a celebrity. He thinks that everybody knows who he is just because he runs like one dinky little town where I live. Like, well, that's not really the case. I mean, he's not the president. I mean, he just runs one little town. You know, he kind of lets the whole fame and fortune kind of get to his head because he knows that people have been like, you know, kind of following him. But anyway, no, you're absolutely right. I think you bring up some very good points there, and it's you're right. I mean, it's all about, you know, quantity instead of quality. It's like people will just throw stuff at a wall and hope it sticks, and that's what you got for a lot of what's out there. So now I wanted to ask you about the revivals. Have you been able to see some of these revivals that Nickelodeon's put out in the last year, like Double Dare and all that, and Are You Afraid of the Dark, which just came out this the other day? Have you watched all that yet?
You know, I really haven't. I stopped watching Nickelodeon both because, you know, I was getting a bit older, and also because it's when kind of the changeover happened when I was around 12 or so. And, you know, they even did change, you know, before they started doing some of these reboots, they did change their programming a great deal a little later down the road, from being what was called transgenerational before. A lot of the shows that we watch, that, you know, you could watch if you're a kid, you can watch if you're an older brother or sister, you can watch if you're a babysitter, the parents, you know, stoner college kids who are watching some of the stuff like late night rerun again. To, you know, they really were focusing on 6 to 11. And that's why so many of the shows, especially in the early 2000s and such, were really more for a much younger audience and not really for older people to enjoy, as many of those earlier shows were, until they started doing some of these reboots again. So I'll just say, you know, I didn't really keep up with Nickelodeon over the years. And, you know, like I said, sometimes reboots can be fun, and sometimes I'm interested, but there are also times where it's like I kind of want to hold on to my memory. You know, call me stubborn or misogynistic or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, there's just certain things that I'd rather not see a new version of, or listen to a new version of, or whatever it might be, because I just have very special memories, personal memories connected with the earlier stuff. And also, you know, you could kind of look into who's working on it, who's making it, you know, and sometimes I'll say, well, you know, I don't necessarily know if I want to watch that just because it's the new version of something that I enjoyed when I was younger. You know, truth be told, too, aside from I do my best to keep up with movies, but aside from that, I really don't engage or watch a lot of new stuff on TV, say. You know, I don't read a lot of new novels. I don't listen to a lot of new music. I am kind of an old school guy when it comes to a lot of this stuff. I enjoy watching a lot of the new movies and keeping up with that. But, you know, and I read up a lot on television, and I read a lot of interviews, and I kind of, you know, it's my business. I keep as much into it as possible. Certain shows I still watch here or there. But, you know, it's very time consuming. I don't really have that time. You know, I just, it's a rabbit hole that I don't really fall into as much anymore and don't pay as much attention to. Probably somewhat to my detriment. It probably keeps me from knowing a lot of what's going on, you know, even though I read these interviews, and a lot of my friends make some of these shows, in fact, and I go to meetings and stuff in LA and New York every now and then, for development meetings and other things and stuff. I'm trying to pitch myself, for example, or when I'm doing some of these interviews with people for articles or books or whatever. So, you know, I keep my nose in it as much as I can, but actually sitting down and watching these things is just something I don't really do. I never saw it in the new Double Dare. You know, honestly, I wasn't really that interested in the YouTube star that they got to host it. I have not yet seen the new Are You Afraid of the Dark, literally just because I haven't had a chance to. The Legend of the Hidden Temple movie didn't really look like my cup of tea, so I didn't give that a look. So, yeah, a lot of this stuff I haven't really seen for various reasons. But, you know, again, then I'll talk with DJ Mikkel, the creator of Are You Afraid of the Dark, and see how things are going. And he actually wasn't even really involved in any of the new stuff. A lot of the people who were involved in the earlier shows weren't really involved in some of the reboots. That's not always the case. They're not always going to be involved in it later on. One of my old professors from film school wrote the original Top Gun with his writing partner, for example, and I don't think he has anything to do with the new Top Gun. So, you know, because it's not his property. It's the studio owns it. They can do whatever they want with it. So I just read a really interesting interview from a while back with a hero of mine named Bruce J. Friedman. He's an old comedy writer. Some of the more popular things that he's written that you might have heard of was like movie Splash. And The Lonely Guy that Steve Martin was in, which he wrote the book for that. But he was saying he wrote a short story that became a movie, The Heartbreak Kid, that Elaine May made in the 70s, and then it was remade again by the Farrelly brothers with Ben Stiller. And he was saying that he really liked the beginning of the new version, Heartbreak Kid, but then it sort of fell apart. And he said, you know, so many people worked on that script, and you could see all the credits of all the people who worked on the script, and he knows that there were a lot more people who worked on it who weren't even credited. And he goes, they never once gave me a call. It's like, why don't you call the guy, if you're having some trouble, call the guy who wrote the original story. You know,
yeah,
like, I might have suggestions for you guys.
I'm surprised these people wouldn't do that more. You'd figure they would go to the original source for help if they're bringing something back, but it's like they're almost trying to make it into their own thing. More.
I think that has a lot to do with it. I actually do. Obviously, you know, there's no question there's a lot of ego and that kind of thing in that community. And also, it's a money thing. I mean, the more people that they might bring on, you know, the more money they're going to have to spend. As you said, they want to do their own thing with it. I also just read Murray Langston's autobiography, who is known as the Unknown Comic. He was on shows like The Gong Show and such. George Clooney made this fantastic movie about the main Gong Show guy, Chuck Barris. He also did a bunch of other game shows in the 70s and 80s called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, based on Chuck Barris's book. And one of the characters in it is the Unknown Comic. And Murray Langston, in his autobiography, explains that he didn't even know the movie was getting made. He had remained friendly with Chuck Barris over the years, but didn't realize that the movie was being made on his book. And he just got a call randomly from some actor who said he was going to be playing him in the movie. And Murray was a little upset about it because he was like, well, A, maybe I should play him, and B, don't they want to talk to me to know more about it? So he actually was able to get in touch with the people making Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, not George Clooney, but one of the producers, and said, you know, couldn't I play that part? And the guy goes, well, it's an age issue. And it's like, well, no, it's not. I'd have a bag over my head. You're not going to know how old I am.
Yeah.
And then they went back and forth. And, you know, he felt that they were, you know, doing some stuff with it when he started learning more that he didn't particularly care for. And he thought that he should get, you know, compensated for them using the character and such. And he looked into it, and he was actually able to make that happen. And I think in the actual movie now, they do an interview with him, because there's, in addition to the feature film aspect of it, there's also sort of a documentary aspect where they interview people like Dick Clark and such about Chuck Barris. And I think one of the interviews is with the actual Murray Langston. But, you know, he talked about in the book, it's like he wasn't looking, you know, to shut the production down. He wasn't looking for a $1 million paycheck. But it's like, hey, man, why not call the guy who actually created the character you're going to have in your movie? And, you know, if you have a little extra in the budget to give me a couple bucks, I'd be happy to consult. And, you know, you're using my character. Like, you know, give me something.
Or maybe give him like a little cameo or something, or some mention of the credits,
right,
at
exactly.
least. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's good for him, but it's also, again, it's good for the audience and the watchers, too, because then you're having someone who's actually involved in it and who actually was that guy, you know, helping to inform how the character is played and all that kind of stuff. And that just makes things better. So to find out that the original person who might have been involved in an original production, original book or something, is not involved in the new movie or the new TV show or the new book or whatever it is, yeah, of course, it's going to, you know, raise some suspicions in me, and I'm going to say, I'm not sure. It's one of the reasons why, here's a good example, I love the first two Terminators. I mean, they were big, as much as Nickelodeon. I was a kid whose parents didn't always mind what I was watching. So I was watching Terminator 1 and 2 when I was very, very young. And they were favorite movies of mine. I thought I was going to become a robot maker when I was growing up, you know, because before I really got into the writing thing more. Because I just loved robots, and I loved Terminator 1 and 2, and of course Short Circuit, you know, fly the Navigator and everything. To me, it was all the same. I wasn't really paying attention to the swearing or the violence or anything in Terminator 1 and 2. I was just like, I love the idea of robots. Really, really into them. Watched them a million times over. It was just, I was obsessed with Terminator 1 and 2. When the new ones came out, I didn't see them because they didn't seem that interesting. James Cameron wasn't involved. I know he wasn't very happy with what they were doing with it. And I just sat there and I said, you know, I'm not going to tarnish my memories of these two really great movies of this, you know, intellectual property, this IP, with these sequels or reboots or whatever that are just, I can't imagine them being as good. However, now I am going to see the new one because, you know, James Cameron is involved again. Linda Hamilton's back. She's an amazing actress and I know she cares very much about this, about the story as well. And so for her to be involved says a lot. It's also directed by Tim Miller. I love his Deadpool movies. So I know that even the person actually directing it, even though it's not James Cameron, is somebody whose movies I appreciate and like. So I'm very excited to see the new Terminator, even though I didn't see, you know, the ones in the middle. And it was just because, you know, I love the story, but I'm not interested in seeing a reboot that or a sequel that I don't think is going to be as good as the originals. Whereas this next one, hopefully, it stacks up. You know, we'll see it. Now James Cameron's back, and Tim Miller's making it, and Linda Hamilton's in it, and Arnold, and like, heck let's give it a shot. So,
Yeah, it just seems like the originals are just so much better because than any sort of reboot or revival. And you know, I'm it's nice to know that you like you're kind of an old school kind of guy. I'm very much an old school person. So, although. Maybe a slight difference between me and you is I am willing to give some of these revivals a chance because, for one thing, it brings back old memories, but also I kind of want to see, like, how people kind of present something their own way and put their own spin on it without, you know, damaging, I guess, the original, you know, at least, like, you know, keep the original tech but kind of just put their own fresh spin on it. I'm open to, like, these ideas of reviving things. I just hope they don't change these things too much to where it feels like a completely different thing. That's probably what was the case with you with the Terminator movies, is that, you know, it wasn't exactly the same people producing it. It was a completely different, you know, staff.
Yeah, it just becomes a whole other thing. And, you know, I always even think that clear to bring it back to Nickelodeon again. You know, people will sometimes ask me, well, you know, why didn't you talk about some of these other later shows or whatever it is? And I would say the same thing, which is, look, the period of time I was writing about Nickelodeon, this so-called golden age, you know, they were all made by this, you know, same group of people, basically, that were doing everything. And people like Jerry Laybourne and Darby and some of the others that were supervising everything, and they were, everybody was passing along, you know, different story editors, and Will McRobb is making a bunch of heat, but he's also a story editor on the Nicktoons, and Mitchell Kriegman, same thing, you know, he was doing Clarissa, but he was also story editing some of the other shows, and, you know, Alan Goodman was involved in a lot of the different shows and kind of bouncing around also. So, you know, it was this, you know, group of artists and writers and filmmakers and such that were kind of all doing this stuff together. And then they left. And then it became a whole other thing. And I always say, you know, it really would be like going back to your favorite Chinese restaurant that you used to go to all the time when you were a kid, you know, when you're visiting, you know, your parents or whatever it is, and now it's an Italian restaurant. You know, it's the same building, but it's a different staff and it's a different menu. And that, I feel very strongly about that with Nickelodeon. I mean, it's like, just because it's Nickelodeon doesn't necessarily, which I loved as a kid when they had certain shows on the 80s and early 90s, doesn't mean I'm going to keep watching it now. I mean, it's a totally different thing now. It's completely different. It became completely different as soon as Jerry Laybourne left that office. The channel changed entirely. Same name. And it really is that Chinese restaurant, Italian restaurant metaphor. You know, it really is basically, you know, the same building, but different staff and different menu. And so I would have no interest in that. And, you know, honestly, a lot of it comes down to time. I mean, I like to try to keep up with stuff as much as I can, but I just find that I end up not really liking a lot of new television. Don't really like the way a lot of it's shot. I don't really like a lot the way the music is done. I don't really connect with the characters often. So forth. I can go on. When my wife and I do watch TV, we end up almost always watching older stuff. And, you know, the newest stuff we watch is, for example, we have a weird addiction to Sex and the City. So we watch Sex and the City over and over again a lot. You know, the Larry Sanders Show with Gary Shandling. You know, we watched this great cartoon that was on HBO for a short time called The Life and Times of Tim, which I think was on in the early 2000s. Nobody I've ever met has ever heard of, but it's an amazing show. And then we watch a lot of older stuff. We watch original Twilight Zone. We watch a lot of Green Acres. you know, we basically almost watched a lot of what would be, you know, like Nick at Night stuff, you know?
Right, yeah.
So,
yeah, you know,
yeah,
yeah,
get enough of Green Acres. It's great, you know.
Green Acres is the place to be. I'm loving
it. I will say one other thing about this, yeah, just because I think it's an interesting story. The noir, you know, kind of detective, hard-boiled story writer, Raymond Chandler, I forget who told this story, but somebody was at a party at his house and apparently said to him, you know, Raymond, doesn't it upset you how Hollywood has made all these movies that have ruined your books? And apparently Raymond Chandler kind of just smirked and then escorted the guy to his library and opened up the door and showed this guy, you know, all of his books and everything. And then he pointed to his books that he'd written. And he goes, they didn't ruin anything. They're right there. You know, and it's
right.
Like, I think that that's a really good story. I think that's a really good idea. It's like, yeah, I like a lot of people, I didn't particularly care for the new Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie, even though I'm a big Tim Burton fan. But I love the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Now, did the new one ruin the old one? Not necessarily. I mean, it's still out there. It's, you can still see it. You can still watch it. And if anything, maybe the new one might get people to say, wow, you know, I didn't particularly like that. I wonder if there's other versions, or if they might look into it, or how was the movie made, or whatever. See, oh, there was an older one. Let me see that. Oh, that was much better. Or maybe some people might feel, oh, that was much worse. I mean, it's all opinion anyway.
Right.
But
yeah, I can understand all this. I mean, I'm a purist when it comes to old TV shows and movies. Like, I grew up watching a lot of reruns of old game shows and sitcoms. Like, but with me, it was either the three channels I watched the most growing up were Nickelodeon, TV Land, and Game Show Network. That's all I watched as a kid. That's all I grew up with, was all these reruns of old shows. And
sure,
you know, I was never one that was like up on modern pop culture. I was always into the old stuff. And I think, and with my family, like we watch a lot of older movies and watch a lot of reruns of old shows as well. So like,
right,
I almost have completely no sense of what goes on now, in a sense, just because of that. And yeah, I mean, I am one of those people that, like you, that thinks older is better. I mean, older is the original is what worked. And I think back in the day, there was a sense of, I don't know, maybe just with Nickelodeon, like we were mentioning earlier, there was a more sense of realism and you know, you can relate to the kids a lot more. I mean, but with a lot of these older sitcoms, like you see on like Nick at Night or TV Land, it's like, I mean, some of them were a bit corny, but at least they were, you know, they were positive. They were fun. They were entertaining. They made you take your mind off the real world. And that's what I like about those old shows. They, you know, they made you like, you know, kind of put you in like a fantasy for a little bit. It's just that you don't have to think about your everyday problems.
Right, and again, even a show, like a lot of, this would probably surprise a lot of people, but Green Acres and a lot of other shows back in the day were actually quite creative and were quite smart. And to me, what I love about them is that they are kind of goofy and silly and fun and escapist, but they're also very cleverly made. You had really good actors, you had some really good casting. There's a lot of meta comedy on a show like Green Acres that would probably surprise people. You know, they sometimes will reference the credits in the show. Lisa, his wife, you know, will literally point out the credits and we'll be talking about them. Or there was an episode where she was talking, where someone was talking about something and it was like a political rant or something like that. And in the background, you can hear, you know, flutes playing like it would like in an episode or something like that. Sort of this very patriotic music. And at a point, Lisa turns and goes, "Can they turn that music down, please? I can't hear what he's saying." And it's like, and it's totally breaking the fourth wall. And it's just, it's funny that you'd see this goofy, silly show like Green Acres, and most people who haven't ever seen it, or maybe watched it when they were younger but haven't returned to it, it's like you watch it, this is really smart stuff. I mean, even when you watch something like A Married with Children, or obviously, you know, probably the best example would be something like All in the Family, it's like, yeah, they're sitcoms, and they're kind of goofy, and they're kind of silly. Obviously, All in the Family dealt with pretty tough topics as well, which is part of the intention of that. But even some of the goofier, sillier episodes, you know, it still was, you had really good actors, you had really good writing, and they still were well made and that kind of stuff. Now, I think that it goes back to, you know, I don't necessarily know if it's laziness or what, but it just seems like they're not trying as hard. And, you know,
I agree.
Okay, they got the celebrities in it, everybody looks really good, you know, they're living in these nice houses or whatever it is. You know, the music is loud and booming, the camera's all over the place, the editing's really fast, And, you know, then people afterwards say, oh, how smart it is and how fresh and how new and groundbreaking and all this. And I sit there and I go, you know, this isn't anything to me. And when I'm watching something even like, you know, Wonder Years or Married with Children or All in the Family or, you know, so many of the great shows that were coming out, you know, in earlier years or even some of the early Nickelodeon, obviously. I mean, Adventures of Pete and Pete. I've talked about this many times before, but it's just such a special show. And I can't imagine a show like that, whether for kids or adults coming out today. Like, I don't even know what that pitch meeting would be like because it's so weird and it's so goofy and crazy. You know, and there are things that might come out like Rick and Morty or whatever, but that happened because of what we were talking about before about unaided awareness and personal branding. That happened because Dan Harmon was, you know, a legend in the comedy writing industry and was basically given a free pass to do whatever he wanted. And he made this show Rick and Morty happen. And, you know, it is really anarchic and crazy and chaotic. And again, I can't even imagine what the pitch meeting was like to pitch a show like that.
Right.
But it probably was, hey, Dan, what do you want to do next? Oh, I want to do this. Okay, you're the keys. Enjoy. You know, I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. But, you know, I know that Dan being a part of it was obviously a big part of how a show like that got made. And so, you know, but to actually go in there and say, we're going to do this really weird, unique, crazy thing, you know, they're going to just look at you and kind of cross-eyed and go, what you're talking about. You know, we want another show of a bunch of, you know, sexy 20-year-olds, you know, pretending like they're working hard to live in the city and, you know, have a couple of daily challenges that are, you know, not real or whatever, you know, just, or, you know, cop show or whatever it might be, some family drama that's really theatrical and a little over the top and not necessarily connecting with a lot of regular people. So, you know, it's just hard for me to watch a lot of that stuff, even when I'm trying to for research or to kind of know what's going on. I poke in and out, or I'll ask friends about it, or, you know, sometimes if something's on at a friend's house, I'll sit down and actually watch it for a little while. Like, all right, let me, you know, here it is. Let me see what this show's about. Let me see what everybody's talking about with this. And I'll watch a couple episodes, and almost always I'm disappointed. I just, can't really connect with new television for some reason.
Yeah, I can't connect with new television either. I feel like one thing that a lot of older shows had that you never see anymore nowadays is, and I see this on a lot of the old sitcoms I watch, like you mentioned, like All in the Family, and I see this with like Full House and Family Matters, is that even though at times they were a bit silly, they weren't afraid to get serious. So they would address serious issues, and by the end of the show, the characters learn a lesson or some kind of moral. You know, you learn something by the end of the show. Nowadays, everything is so mindless. Like, you don't learn anything. Yeah. It's just a bunch of random crap thrown together with bad editing or bad acting or just loud music. Like you said, it's like, oh, this is the show we got. And it's like, I don't understand how in the world people are interested in that. I mean, I actually expect quality instead of just superficialness.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's debatable, and you know, but I tend to agree with that, and you know, it's something too. You know, I don't want to keep picking new television. Sorry, I'm trying to get my headphones, and they just fell off. You hear me?
You there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you. I'm here. I can hear you.
Yeah,
keep
sorry
going.
About that. Yes, sorry about that. But so much of the new television too. Yeah, it's the camera's all over the place, the editing's all over the place, and it's all so loud. It's just people shouting the whole time. You know, I find this in a lot of comedies too. It's hard to watch a lot of the new movie comedies even, because it seems like somewhere along the line, some of these screenwriters realized, or the directors or whomever realized, well, if we can't be that funny in this scene, let's at least have the characters yell at each other, you know, and you just see, and it's loud. And yeah, sometimes that can be fun and funny and a crazy character. As I said, look, I used to love Ren and Stimpy, and that's pretty much all just shouting the whole time. But so many of these new TV shows, it just seems like they're just so loud. I even have tried watching some of the animated stuff, again, just to stay in the loop. And, you know, again, I don't want to name names because I'm going to be really critical here, but there's two or three that I know are very popular and that a lot of people watch, a lot of people talk about, a lot of people think I would like, because it's, you know, they think it's the same kind of humor as some of the other shows I like, The Simpsons or South Park or whatever. But I just, there's two or three of them that I'm thinking about right now where it's just like, I've tried watching them, it's just people screaming at each other. And, you know, A, it's really negative and really toxic, and B, it's just loud. It's like, I don't want to be too much of a crotchety old man here,
But it's like, calm down. Like, there's enough screaming and yelling on the news and
in
out
real
in the
life.
World. And yeah, like, it's just like, you know, I like to be able to watch a show. When you watch something, even like another good example of a great old show would be something like Sanford and Son. You know, and these are all, you know, some of these great, you know, Norman Lear shows and whatnot. You know, you watch something like Sanford and Son, and yeah, the characters can be, you know, really angry and fierce, and obviously Red Fox has his moments of his temper tantrums and whatever it is, but for the most part, there's a certain calmness to it. And it's not just like cut, and music that's really loud and all that stuff. And yeah, it's, you know, part of me is like, oh, now I sound like I'm complaining about the damn kids and their MTV video games. But at some point, you do have to sit back and say, wait, there was something really special about a show like Sanford and Son or All in the Family, where even when there was anger, even when there was negativity that they were dealing with in the show and the characters, there was still a certain calmness, a certain order, where you can really sit and enjoy it rather than feel like you're being attacked by it so aggressively. And that's, I think, a big part of why it's hard for me to watch a lot of new television.
I agree with you. The older shows are a lot more comforting, and there was a sense of calmness. You're exactly right. There, you know, that it's just the way it was presented back then. I mean,
they
normally
left you alone. They left you alone. You could really kind of just sit there and enjoy it. And even when, as you said, I agree, even some of the goofiest shows dealt with very serious topics at times. You know, now they even make fun of them with like a very special episode of blah blah blah. And yeah, you know, some of that's warranted, but you know, the fact that they had an episode of Mr. Belvedere where they're dealing with a kid who has AIDS, you know, I mean, and before that was really even talked about in a large way, it's like, wow, you can't think of a goofier, sillier show than Mr. Belvedere. But for them to deal with a topic like that in such a sober, calm way is really special. And now, when you have TV shows that deal with, you know, tough topics or just in general, they don't let you just sit there and enjoy it. They're trying to rouse you. They're trying to raise your cockles. And, you know, I think a lot of it is they want to get you more emotionally invested so that you'll keep watching, you'll binge watch, and you'll go to these conventions and so forth, rather than just relying on the good acting, relying on the good screenwriting, and even, for the most part, relying on the really good ways the shows were shot. I mean, when you watch Cheers, I mean, that is amazing that a show lasted for whatever it was, 11 or 12 seasons.
11 years.
That's basically, it's basically a bunch of people sitting around a bar talking. Wow. What a boring, slow, who cares, banal idea. And yet, right from the get-go, it worked. And, you know, became this huge show later down the road. And we're still talking about it today. And, you know, the people who shot it, and the people who edited it, and Jim Burrows, who directed almost every episode, and directed a lot of other big shows like Taxi and such from that time. You know, I mean, it's just like really had a craftsmanship to it. And there's a show where you could have just had the camera wherever you wanted and blah, blah, blah. And who cares? Because it's just a bunch of talking. But they shot it like a movie. And it was done like it was a play almost, like this improv play. It felt so real. And yeah, even when there was obviously goofiness and some of the stuff with Woody Harrelson, whatever. Yeah, it could be kind of, you know, corny and Sam Malone, the sort of suave, you know, charmer and everything. Yeah, it was a sitcom, no question. It's not a documentary or you know, a drama or anything. But it still had a certain realness to it, a certain calmness to it, and a certain craftsmanship to it. You know, and
definitely.
I think that's why it was so successful with such what would otherwise seemingly be a really boring idea. But they made it work because all the people involved in that show were so incredibly talented and indeed did a lot before and after. I mean, it's one of the things that Sam Simon came off of, obviously, when he was still quite young and, you know, was able to go on and do, you know, The Simpsons. And so, you know, or again, Jim Burrows, who was directing a lot of the episodes. I mean, he did a ton of stuff. I mean, someone should write a book or make a documentary about Jim Burrows. He's the guy, most people wouldn't even know his name, and he's responsible for, like, most television that came out, like, in the 70s and 80s, you know?
I honestly hadn't even known who he was before he said his name. I didn't even know he directed Cheers, honestly, and I know a lot about TV, so even I learned that just now.
Yeah.
But you know, you were mentioning about, like, shows that, you know, that address real issues. I mean, one of them that just came to mind as you were saying all that was Growing Pains. I mean, there was an episode of that where Kirk Cameron's character, Mike Seaver, was at a party. This was like in the early episodes, and where him and his friends got offered like cocaine. And you know, that was a really funny, silly show too. And you know, it wasn't afraid to address that and how he dealt with that. And I mean, it was very powerful. You know, there was a lot of coming of age in that show and a lot of others in like the Wonder Years, which was also created by the same people that created the, you know, Growing Pains. So, I mean, there was a lot of that, you know, at the time. And I feel like it's disappointing that a lot of pop culture lacks the sort of, I guess, teachable moments with morals and lessons. And there's not as much of a sense of realism anymore. Now it's all about, it's just like you said, it's like loud and in your face. And it's like,
right.
There's so much of the authenticity, I guess, missing from these shows. They're just not as comforting or as easy to watch anymore.
Yeah. You know, and we'll see what happens. You know, I'm hoping that there will be change that will happen. And again, as I said, and I would recommend this to any of your listeners who might be feeling the same way, because I know a lot of people do, because I've lived and moved all over the country and have written and interviewed people in all different facets of life and whatnot. So I know that what we're saying right now is more popular of an opinion than you might think. You know, just people who don't have the opportunity to write about or talk about this in, you know, in large, you know, media outlets or whatever it might be. But there's definitely, I think, a sense and a feeling that's very resonant, that we're having more and more trouble connecting with a lot of the new television, which is a shame, because, yeah, it's just TV and it seems like a luxury and who really cares. But at the same time, as we've just talked about a bunch, and why I think people are still talking about my Nickelodeon book or whatever these Nickelodeon shows is, those things are an important part of who we become as people, especially when it's stuff for kids. You know, I'm so happy that Pixar was around. And, you know, over the last couple of years, obviously, they've had their ups and downs, but we really got to see some of these amazing movies that were good for adults, good for kids. I mean, Finding Nemo or The Incredibles or the Toy Story movies are just
Toy Story
so special.
Yeah.
I mean, and there again, it's like they're fun. They're goofy. It's talking toys. You know, it's Randy Newman music. You can't get more dreamlike and fun and silly. And yet they also deal with real issues about growing up and moving and even, again, class issues and friendship and sharing, and in ways that are not like, you know, beating you over the head with it. And that's really amazing that, you know, that we had those movies, you know, also a little bit later in our childhood, and that those movies are still out there. And, you know, every now and then Pixar still puts out something that is pretty decent, you know, better than most, really. So I'm glad that can still go on. You know, I'm just hoping that, you know, television will pick up on that, because I enjoy reading. I enjoy sitting and listening to records. I enjoy, you know, doing things other than TV. But it's nice sometimes to sit down and veg out. And when I want to watch something new and there's nothing good on, that kind of sucks. I mean, I miss having, you know, some of that stuff on. But what I would suggest to your listeners is, you know, this is a good time to go back and to revisit shows like Green Acres, or to watch shows maybe you've never seen before but have read about or heard about. I'm sure there are a lot of people who've never watched the original Twilight Zone episodes. And you cannot get better television than the original Twilight Zone. It's got to be the best television that's ever been made. And
absolutely,
you know, you can go back and watch those. So, yeah, you know, like, that's what I would do. And that's what, frankly, again, my wife and I do, is we'll watch sometimes. I mean, you watch a show like the Larry Sanders Show, and, I mean, talk about just, like, great from start to finish, and a lot of amazing people involved in it, and deals with a lot of real life topics, even though he's a talk show host, but still deals with some of the kind of behind the scenes stuff, and all very accurate. I know for a fact, because I know some of the people who worked on it, you know, and have become friendly with them over the years now too, that a lot of it was based on real things that were going on in Gary Shandling's life or going on, you know, in the world at that time or whatever it is. You know, Sarah Silverman and Marilyn Ray Scubb and Scott Thompson, a lot of the other people who were on that show when they were a lot younger, Janine Garofalo, who I've interviewed more than once now. You know, when I've talked with them about some of these things, you know, it was very real and it was very true. And you watch it, it's like, it's so funny and it's so honest, and you connect so much with the characters. And, you know, the way that it's shot, the way that it's edited, the way that they use music, it really is like they're making little films. So I would say, if you can't find anything on TV right now that's any good, that's new, this is a perfect time to go back and see some of those great classics, you know, from earlier days, like Twilight Zone or, you know, Sanford and Son or All in the Family, or, yeah, Larry Sanders, for sure. I mean, some of the stuff would surprise you. I go back and watch, like I said, some of the Married with Children. And, yeah, there were a lot of episodes that were a bit much, but some of them were really good writing, really good direction, really good acting. They're again, making, you know, important points about classism and the working class man and woman and all these kinds of things that you don't really see anymore. So, you know, even a show like Married with Children that, you know, a lot of people probably write off because, oh, it's just this goofy, offensive show. Who cares? You know, you go back to it now and it's like, as adults watching it and having gone through a lot of the things that Peggy and Al have gone through and the kids went through and everything else, you know, I have a special affinity for it again. I really just started revisiting it in the last year or so. And I'm so glad that I have. So I would just tell people, you know, if you don't like what's on TV now, watch the older stuff. And hopefully maybe at some point, you know, the powers that be will get the message that, you know, they need to go back to making these great shows like Wonder Years. I mean, you watch an episode of the Wonder Years and it really is like a little short film. I mean, there's just nothing like it on now, you know? I mean, they're not even trying, it seems, really.
No, they're not. You know, it's funny you mentioned All in the Family. You know, earlier this year, I don't know if you saw this, but they actually did do a live restage of All in the Family and the Jeffersons for ABC. They did a live episode of those shows, and Jimmy Kimmel spoke with Norman Lear prior to those to them performing it, and it was done completely live, not pre-recorded. There actually was one blooper, I think, that they one of them messed up a line at one point, but they kept right on going and didn't let it affect them. It was outstanding. They might even do it again at some point. The ratings were so good for it. So there is somewhat of a comeback for watching older stuff, I guess, again. But yeah, I completely agree with you. Again, I mean, I don't mean to sound like a crotchety old man here, but you know, for those listening to this, like Matt said, after the show, go to your computer or go to Netflix, look up all these old shows we're talking about, gain an appreciation for them, watch them, and realize just how much better the quality was compared to what they have now. I mean, the difference is unbelievable, really.
It really is. Yeah. No, it really is. And I actually just read a book I can recommend. We talked about it in my Simpsons book, Springfield Confidential. Also, and probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with it because it's fairly popular, but this contributing editor for Vanity Fair named Mike Sachs, who writes a lot about comedy and whatnot. He came out with this book in 2014 called Poking a Dead Frog. And it's him interviewing all the top comedy writers of the period, as well as a lot of older folks. One of the women that he interviews was 96 at the time of her interview. She actually wrote for some of the original radio shows and the earliest sitcoms. He actually talks to a couple people that are quite old. I mean, you know, the last interview is even with Mel Brooks. But he talks to just about everybody and anybody you could imagine, people who do who are doing stuff online, people who do TV, late night, cartoons, movies, all different kinds of things. Really, really great book, Poking a Dead Frog. You know, you really get a sense of how smart a lot of these people were. In fact, he talks to either Glenn or Les Charles, who was one of the main people at Cheers and was one of the main writers at Cheers. And you know, you read these people's interviews and you just sit there and you go, and these are really smart, sensitive, articulate people who are really nailing. I mean, some of the stuff that some of the people were saying, it transcended comedy and television and pop culture, the movies or whatever it was they were talking about or their chosen medium, to just life lessons. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons that we read books like this, and hopefully maybe even might be lofty to say, but people read a book even like Slimed, because it's not just people talking about TV or comedy or Nickelodeon. It's also just them talking about their lives and how they get by and maybe how they got successful or dealt with failure or whatever it might be. You get those little nuggets in a book like Slimed or a book like what I'm talking about, Poking a Dead Frog. And you know, there just is this sense of reading interviews with these people, and they're so smart and sensitive and aware. And then you read an interview with some of the people who work on the TV shows now, and or you see the stuff they tweet or whatever it is. And then, you know, they just don't seem like they have that same kind of sophistication and panache and charm. And, the ability to communicate that someone like, I read Norman Lear's autobiography, Even This I Get to Experience, which I also highly recommend and is really good and is really smart. And you know, the people today don't hold a candle to someone like a Norman Lear or a James L. Brooks or a Sam Simon or a Matt Groening or, you know, some of these people who made all these amazing TV shows back in the day. You know, the people, you read the interviews with them now. I mean, like I said, I like to keep up just to know what's going on. And, you know, all I can say is you sit there and you go, geez, no wonder that their shows seem so intellectually bereft, or whatever, or insensitive, or don't really connect with people. I don't know. I mean, it just, you can tell even with the interviews, and I like to keep up with interviews And it's one of the reasons why I like reading biographies and autobiographies, especially old comics, George Burns and Phyllis Diller Dick Gregory and you know, Lenny Bruce, obviously, and Joan Rivers. You know, you read some of these biographies or these interviews or such with some of these pioneers of comedy, and they were really smart people who were really aware of society and other people around them. And,
they really
you know, the
are.
Folks now, yeah, the folks now, especially, you know, a lot of people in the comedy world now, it's just, I don't know, I don't know what to say.
I too am a fan of the old pioneers of creators of some of my favorite game shows, and they share the same kind of values that these other people did, in the sense that they knew they were smart people, they knew what worked, and they knew what people wanted. You know, it's almost like they put themselves in the viewer's shoes and thought, what do I want to see? And it just worked every time. Nowadays, it just seems like everybody goes off in their own direction and does what they think is best instead of what they want, they think the viewer will like. And it just doesn't work. You I think that's why they can't connect with audiences as well.
Right. No, I think there's a lot of points. Plus, they're using a lot of things that they didn't use back in the day. Like, there's a lot more focus groups now, and, you know, algorithms and, you know, recommendations and all these different things. They're letting the computers make the decisions now. And again, that's even when a lot of that stuff tends to be wrong, which is very often the case, they at least can use that again to leverage themselves and say, well, I know this show didn't work out, boss, but it should have. Look at all the data that we had that showed that this should have worked. It's not my fault. You know, something must have went wrong elsewhere. So it's a way for them to leverage themselves. If the show or a movie doesn't work out, they can show, hey, look at all the data show that it should have worked out. So they're going off of data, they're going off of these algorithms and computerized things and these focus groups and things like that that really weren't used back in the day necessarily. There was a little bit of that going on since the beginning of entertainment, sure. Even the Marx Brothers used to have preview screenings and things. They would literally cut out jokes that didn't get laughter, and there were other people that did similar things. So, you know, this is not that new necessarily. It's just being done much, much more now. And you're right. You know, there's not ever going to be a computer that's going to understand, or an algorithm that's going to understand how comedy works, or even drama or something, and humanity as a Norman Lear or as a James L. Brooks or someone of that stature who consistently made Gary Marshall, you know, consistently made these shows that really connected with people, even if they were goofier, sillier, or whatever. You know, I mean, Mork and Mindy is a pretty goofy show, and you know, it's a spin-off from another goofy show, Happy Days.
Happy Days,
and yet you watch it, and as goofy and silly and manic as Robin Williams is on that show, and the rest of the characters and a lot of the stuff that happens on the show, there's some real meaningful moments. And you know, I would suggest anybody who is listening to this, you know, still, if they're still holding on here, to watch this, an episode of Mork and Mindy where Robin Williams, the comedian, actually comes to town. Following up the show, I don't know if you're aware of it, or a lot of people are, but it actually takes place in Boulder. And so, you know, Robin Williams comes to Boulder, and they actually do the whole thing of, like, it's Mork and it's Robin Williams. I think they even have a scene or two of them together and do sort of the split screen thing. But,
oh, that's cool. I don't think I saw that episode.
you've got to see it, because not only is it kind of interesting and funny, but it's sad. I actually read about it in this really great biography of Robin Williams that just came out, just called Robin, by David Itzkoff, the culture, one of the culture editors or whatever it is for New York Times. And he talked about it. And what's sad about it is Mork is really excited to meet Robin Williams, and thinks that Robin Williams has this great life, and it must be so much fun to be a celebrity. It must be so much fun to have people laugh, you know, around you all the time, and to bring so much joy and laughter to people's life. Well, he actually, by the end of the episode, spoiler alert, he learns that Robin Williams' life is not so great. And it actually ends on a very sad note. And even when he's giving his report back to work, you know, as he does at the end of every episode, it actually ends on a very somber note. And there's a moment of basically him being like, boy, maybe Robin Williams' life and a celebrity's life is not all it's cracked up to be. And when you put that in context to what we know ended up happening later down the road, I mean, bam, that hits you hard.
Right.
That's an episode of friggin' Mork and Mindy. You know what I mean? Where they're dealing with, like, celebrityhood and insecurities with oneself, and a cast member from the show basically delving into his darkest self. And this is when, like, Robin Williams was at his, you know, was just peaking, and had, you would think, would have nothing but happiness and joy going on. And he's involved in an episode of his own show where he's basically saying, my life kind of sucks. It's not as great as you think it is. The end. I mean, wow. And that's just something you're not going to see in a TV show today. I'm sorry. I mean, there's just no way.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even think to do something like that today.
You're right. They wouldn't do something like that today. I mean, that's so powerful that they attempted that stuff back then. And, you know,
no actor would put himself or herself through that in a TV show today. Everyone has to, again, it's an aspirational thing. They all have to seem like their lives are the best. I interviewed a gentleman who is like some kind of a clinical psychologist or something like that. He used to do a lot of lectures at Stanford, and he talked to a lot of companies like Google and Facebook and different things of that nature about some of the stuff we're talking about here with insecurities and some of these things. And I had interviewed him, and I actually asked him at a point, I said, why do you think American audiences and a lot of global audiences, but particularly American audiences, it seems right now, are so into the aspirational thing, are so into, you know, going on social media and seeing what all their friends are up to and how great their lives are and who's going on vacation, who's going to Hawaii, and who's, you know, looking good and lost a lot of weight and all this. Where did a lot of this come from? And he feels strongly that it came from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. He feels that that show was extremely destructive to our society as a whole because it really was. And then, you know, you had all these other shows. Yeah, you had all these other shows that came out later, like Cribs on MTV, for example. And literally what they are about is ranking, and they're about here's someone who has a bunch of stuff that you don't have and now you probably want, and you know, and it's addictive to a lot of people. It's why a lot of people are on social media for 4 or 5 hours a day seeing what their friends or celebrities are up to or whatever. You know, I have friends or people that I've known who, especially some of the younger ones, and when they ask me these kinds of things like how I deal with some stuff, I'll tell them outright, I say, stop looking at that stuff, close the computer, turn off your phone. Like, you've got to
get outside.
Go outside, Or, you know what, write your own, you know, you're jealous of somebody who's wrote a book or something, write one. Stop looking up what everybody else is doing. You know, go write your own book. Like, you're wasting time obsessing. And there have been a few people I've had to tell, like, they'll start telling me about some problem they're having. And I know immediately that it's like, stop looking at social media. Stop looking at these other people, whatever it is. I mean, I'm just as much at fault as anybody else a lot of times. Like I said, I read a lot of interviews with people, and I'll look up how, you know, certain filmmakers or actors or such are up to now because I'm interested in them, you know, because of the movies they've made or whatever it might be. So I do that kind of stuff too, but I don't engage in social media for the most part. And I, you know, I don't look up like what friends of mine or whatever are up to. Most of them I still talk to anyway. Because I want to do my own thing, and I want to make stuff, and I want to produce things, and I want to be good with my wife and good with my family and my friends. And to me, that's what it's about. And I don't want to spend all this time looking up other people or being jealous of what they have or don't have. And this gentleman that I spoke to, he said a lot of that came from, you know, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and suddenly he had all these TV shows and all these magazines and all these things about how great all these other people have it. And then it just makes people want that more. And then they're going to try to work harder to get it. And that everything becomes about money and about stuff.
Right.
And they're forgetting those things like what you and I are just talking about of like, go outside and enjoy a nice day, you know, go you know, spend some time with your family or whatever it might be. Go create a play that you can do with your friends, you know, at a community center or something like that. You know, so
it's so hard for people, I think, in general, not to compare themselves to other people, because we all want to be like celebrities or like on these shows. And that's great that you're able to focus on that. I mean, I try to focus on my friends and family and my personal life as well, and it takes a lot of focus to be able to do that and not think about other people. You know, sometimes it's actually a good thing to be a little selfish and think about how you want to live your life instead of trying to be someone you're not. And it's so hard for people to grasp that, because, you know, we've become, you know, I guess suffocated with so much, you know, glamour, and it's like, it's just not like that. It's not all it's cracked up to be.
Right. No, I agree with that 100%. Yeah. I mean, and look again, you know, just to bring it back, and I don't know if we need to wrap it up now or what, but, you know, this is why I worked so hard on Slimed. And this is why I kept trying to do stuff with it thereafter. And still every now and then we'll do interviews like this or whatever it is, because, you know, just as we've been saying all along, you know, these were more than just some goofy kids shows that we watched 30 years ago. They really taught us a lot about who we are as people. They taught us a lot about society as a whole. They gave us a lot of the sense of humor that we have. Some of my favorite moments with some of the people that I met, especially the higher ups like Jerry Laybourne, for example. I got to go to her apartment actually when I was in New York and got to interview her and was really like there with her. It's one of the only times I've actually ever been somewhat starstruck, which is funny because, wow, you know, most people wouldn't even know who she is and they don't know what she looks like necessarily. But I mean, I'm sitting here with like Mrs. Nickelodeon. Like really, and this is definitely one of the themes from the book, as anybody would know, and anybody knows about Nickelodeon would say the same thing, which is Jerry Laybourne really like was Nickelodeon. Yeah, she didn't, you know, her hands weren't as involved in the day-to-day of a lot of these shows and such themselves, but as a full vision, she really was like the Steve Jobs of Nickelodeon. And just like Steve Jobs, yeah, Steve Jobs wasn't a coder, and he wasn't, you know, physically putting a lot of this stuff together, but he was so good at understanding the vision of Apple. And let's face facts, he did it twice. I mean, the guy was a bad guy too, and he made a lot of mistakes, and his personal life was a mess and everything else. But I mean, you have to hand it to a guy who two different times, from when he was first starting Apple to when he came back to fix it and make it into the company that it is today, that was all about his vision and his ability to delegate and his ability to get other people to do what they had to do. And Jerry really was that for Nickelodeon. So to be sitting across from her in her own apartment with her shoes off, and she's just chatting with me like a regular person, which, you know, she very much is, was really amazing. You know, and that was one of the things I asked her was, what's it like sitting with somebody, sitting across from somebody who you helped to raise through a network that you created or that you, you know, developed into what it was. And I asked that question of a few people, and their answers were all very interesting, some of which come up somewhat in the book, or in other things that I've written, but it was kind of cool. And I still have that happen to this day. I mean, I stayed at Mike Reese's apartment when I was in New York for a couple days, this last time that I was there. And, you know, I worked on the Simpsons book with him, Springfield Confidential. And you know, he's one of two people who's written for the Simpsons since it started. He created a lot of the characters that we all know and love. He was show running during two of the best seasons, according to a lot of people. He brought on Conan O'Brien onto the show and really helped to get his career going and all this other stuff.
Wow.
So when I sit and I'm in Mike Reese's apartment and just chatting with him and watching TV with his wife, who's got her, you know, feet up on the coffee table, and we're all as cozy as could be, and they're like my friends that are letting me stay at their apartment.
Yeah,
you know,
that's awesome.
but it's wild. What I'm getting at is it's wild to be there with somebody like that who, you know, helped to create The Simpsons and thus helped to create the person I am today. I can look back at pictures of myself, and I have 3, 4, 5 different pictures of me wearing different Simpsons shirts over the span of 5 or 6 years. I mean, I was a true believer. I was a Simpsons kid growing up. You know, I was there from the very beginning, and I used to watch it every week, and that was my show. You know, and I was wearing Simpsons shirts and wrote about the Simpsons, and now I'm writing about them, and I'm in the apartment of the guy who basically is one of the most responsible for it. And, you know, it's wild, and it's not, and it's more than just a show. It's a big part of how I became the person I am, and I know that it's how a lot of people became the people that they are from watching it.
Right.
And it's how we connected to each other, and it's how we perceive the world. You know, I mean, these things are important. You know, one of my favorite quotes that I've read recently, I can't remember who said it, I wish I did, but someone recently said, why do we keep calling it pop culture? Why do we keep calling it pop culture? Why don't we just say what it is? It is culture. It is the culture. You know what I mean? I mean, what are we talking about? We're talking about music, books, movies, TV, video games, comic books, the radio, I mean, comedy, theater. It's what's constantly surrounding us. It is the culture. I mean, what else is there? You know, there's politics and economics and those kinds of things too, but you know, those are involved in quote unquote pop culture. I really wish I could remember who said it, and they deserve the credit for it. And I think it was kind of recently, but that blew my mind because they're right. It's culture. It's not pop culture. It's culture.
I'm going to remember that. I think it's culture. Yeah. That's all it is.
Yeah,
you're exactly right. Yeah, and you know, and about Geraldine Laybourne, I mean, you know, she really, really put Nickelodeon on the map. I don't think without her, Nickelodeon would have ended up being as big as it turned out to be. I think
absolutely. No, they're they're ready to get rid of it, basically. And, you know, this is some of the stuff I was talking about before that we cut out of the book just because of word space, and I didn't want to kind of bog it down with some of the, again, economics and sort of politics and such of the behind the scenes. But when Sy Schneider was the first person to run Nickelodeon, and he was basically given the keys to the kingdom, you know, to just make it a loss leader, so that they could sell the fuller cable package that had some of the other things on it, like the movie channel and whatnot. And like, oh, we also have this award-winning children's channel too that you get. So go with our package over another cable package. And that's really what it was. Like, he really wasn't minding the store, in the same way that Jerry did when she came on board. Mm-hmm. And when she comes in, it was suddenly like, hey, let's really do something with this. Yeah, we don't have a lot of money. Yeah, we don't have a lot of resources. Yeah, we don't have this, that, or the other. Yeah, nobody's paying attention to us. You know, we're like the worst network, you know, ratings-wise out there. You know, they're ready to basically cut us entirely. You know, but let's just have some fun and do something that we'll enjoy. And you know what? If nothing else, we'll have a really great year together doing a bunch of goofy shows. And hey, there's this show up in Canada that seems really funny where they're sliming kids. And hey, you know, I used to watch Mr. Wizard when I was a kid, and I love watching him. What's he up to today? Can we bring him back? He probably won't be that expensive. Yeah. Let's do something with him. And that way it can be fun and educational too. And you know, she just started popping around. And when, you know, Vanessa Coffey comes in and gets really involved to help to create the Nicktoons block, she and Jerry came up with this wild idea of, hey, rather than going to the usual suspects that are going to be way too expensive and are going to just do the same stuff that we've seen over and over again, let's go and find some weirdos. Let's go and find some people who have been in the trenches and who have just been like hoarding all this great stuff because, you know, they're too scared to show it to anybody because it's too weird or strange or different or whatever. And then, you know, they went around and started talking to, you know, John Cristofolusi and Arlene and Gabor and Paul Germain and, you know, obviously Jim Jenkins and such. And they went and they found weird, crazy stuff that nobody else would have ever thought to put on a children's network to do as animation, you know. And yeah, that's all Jerry Laybourne. I mean, there's no question that she really led that ship. And everybody I talked to agreed with that. Everybody. There was no one who said, nah, that's not necessarily true. There was no one who was like, you know what, Matt, between you and me, you know, that wasn't really the case. Like, everybody made it very clear that, without Jerry, there would not have been Nickelodeon. And so real that, it's possible it would have just, you know, been canceled entirely because when she took it over, it wasn't really doing well because nobody was really making it do well. So, absolutely.
Right. I was actually about to say, I mean, you know, to think what it started off as when it was created 40 years ago, I mean, all they had literally was like a puppet show called Pinwheel and like a bunch of really like pathetically produced shows that just didn't appeal to kids. I mean, if they continued down that path, I mean, Nickelodeon would have probably went out of business. So she saved the network. She greenlit, you know, look at everything that happened under her roof. You Can't Do That on Television, Nick at Night, Double Dare, the Nicktoons block, like you just mentioned, you know, all the shows about kids that we were talking about earlier that, you know, that appealed to kids. I mean, that none of that would have happened had she not been there. I mean, she had a huge impact on kids' lives. And, you know, and I think we owe a lot of what we see or what we grew up with thanks to her. And I hope she understands the impact she had on kids. And I think from what you're saying, she certainly does.
I think she does. I think she does. She's also a very humble person, I found, and other people were saying. And, you know, she's a very special person. She's one of the people I haven't really stayed in touch with. We talked a couple times after the book came out and whatnot. She seemed pleased by it. But, so I don't really want to speak for her because I don't really know for sure. But she always struck me as a very humble person and, you know, was just doing what she was doing. But I felt very lucky to get to meet her, and it really was a reminder when I met her and we were talking about some of this stuff that, these were more than just TV shows. These were more than pop culture. These were culture. These were the things that helped raise us and teach us about life. And, you know, some of the lessons were good and some of the lessons were not so good. And, you know, we had to learn how to make, you know, a lot of our mistakes ourselves. And, you know, no one was there saying, hey, this is a church or a religion or this is the way to lead your life necessarily. But a lot of us still were able to take a lot from it. And whether it was shows like on Nickelodeon or Wonder Years or The Simpsons, or some of these other shows, or even a lot of the movies that really defined our childhood. I mean, obviously not everybody at our age, my age was watching Terminator 2 at that time, but, you know, obviously the big ones like Ghostbusters and Back to the Future and so forth. You know, they were a big part of our childhood, and they were a big part of what connects us to each other now. And
absolutely,
you know, it's fun. Yeah, it's fun to wear. Like, I have a T-shirt with a quote from RoboCop on it, and it's a pretty obscure quote, and it's got a funny picture on it. And it's fun every now and then when someone points it out, and it's just like, okay, they know it too. You know, like, they're a RoboCop fan also. And
yeah,
another movie that I watched when I was probably a little too young for it, but as I said, I was really into robots and things like that. So, you know, and I, RoboCop had a big part of who I became as a person too. Just, there's a lot in that movie. Again, a great example of, yeah, it's got the tits and ass and blood and guts and swearing and craziness and comic book movie stuff, but it's also deals a lot with memory. It deals a lot with the soul. It deals a lot with what it is to be human, what it is to be a being. You know, there's some actually pretty heady stuff in there if you watch it again as an older person. And indeed, I actually had the opportunity to be taught by one of the writers of the movie. He actually came in following up as a substitute in one of my screenwriting classes when I was at film school. And at some point it came up. He said, you know what I was reading while I was working on the RoboCop script? And we go, what? And he goes, philosophy. He goes, I was reading a lot of philosophy books at that time, and I really wanted to bring in, you know, to this kind of, again, sort of goofy shoot 'em up movie, you know, some of these interesting theories and ideas and such about, again, the self and memory and the soul and immortality and life and humanity. And it's like, wow, you know, again, not necessarily something you're going to see too much these days, but
right,
still,
yeah, I
mean, think that's pretty cool.
Definitely. And I mean, I was the same way for the things I like. I mean, I grew up watching a lot of game shows. I mean, I still have a couple of old T-shirts that say, for like, The Price is Right, Come On Down, Family Feud, mm-hmm. Survey Says, you know, and people see that and it immediately brings back memories of what they grew up watching. They're like, hey, I remember that show. That was with Bob Barker when he did it for a long
sure.
time. Or I remember Richard Dawson.
Sure.
You know, it's like it brings back like so many positive memories. And I'm sure that, you know, anyone that's into the same stuff that you're in with like robots and movies and old shows, I mean, if you, you'd probably get the same kind of reaction from people yourself if you, you know, dug that up today. It would be like a collector's
right.
item. So we have been going on for quite a while here. We'll take another break and we'll come back and wrap things up this week with Matt Klickstein, and we'll briefly go over some sports scores for you before the end of the show here, so I want to get that in as well. We'll be back and wrap up the show right after this.
Too much buzz in the air. Listen in to What's the Buzz on EPRN. Sit back and reflect with tunes from the good old days on Reflections, hosted by Cedric Clark on EPRN. Be sure to rock on with Everyone's Rock. Exquisite Podcast Radio Network has a variety of podcast radio programs for listeners all across the globe. Take the journey, the hip-hop and R&B journey with Greg H., or awaken and take notice to the events in your communities with Purposely Awakened, hosted by Naomi Bondman. Hang out with the gents and listen to the Elite Gents podcast. And for better results, listen in to Revealing Better Results. For sports, check out Folksy's Corner, Sports and Stuff, hosted by John Meisner. And PSA, Prodigy Sportative Attestations. Tell a friend and listen in via EPRN's web app at app.eprn.us and listen in online at www.eprn.us.
And we are back here. We've been going on for quite a while here with Matthew Klickstein here. And Matt, I wanted to ask you here before we go here, tell us about some of the books you're writing now, and exactly what you're up to nowadays, and you're out in Colorado where you live.
It's actually been quite a productive year. It's been really exciting. Just for whatever reason, I tend to be a multitasker, and both because I have to be, because the money is not always so high, even for some of these larger projects, especially when you're working on them for 2 or 3 years at a time. I tend to work on a lot of different things at once. You also don't know what's going to succeed or what's going to fail. So I just have found that it's better to work on a bunch of different things. I put as much time and energy as I can in each one. Each one tends to be a passion project. I've been lucky enough to be at that place for the most part right now. But this past year, we had the paperback version of my Simpsons book, Springfield Confidential. The hardcover came out last year. But this year, the paperback came out. So again, we added a few new things to it, a little cheaper than the hardcover, of course. Really proud of that book. I wrote it with Mike Reese, again, one of two people who's written for the show since it started, and really had a big, big impact on the show. I mean, he's right up there with James L. Brooks, Sam Simon, and Matt Groening, along with his former writing partner and former Harvard roomie, Al Jean, who's been running the show since 2001. So that book, the paperback of that came out, as well as some foreign translations, which is really fun. So we're starting to see versions of it come out in Spain and in the United Kingdom, in Germany and some other places, Czech Republic for some reason. And then I did, on assignment, I did kind of an interesting project. I was not familiar with this gentleman beforehand, but my agent suggested I work on the memoirs of a guy named Mr. Skin, who a lot of your listeners probably are familiar with, if they're not fans of Mr. Skin, from the movie Knocked Up. When Seth Rogen's and Jonah Hill's characters are working together to try to create a website that will show where all the celebrity nudity is in all the different movies, that was Judd Apatow was inspired by that because of Mr. Skin, because he was a regular on Howard Stern and a bunch of other things. And he actually has a website that does that. And in fact, they mention it in the movie. There's that scene where Jonah Hill and Seth Rogen's characters see the Mr. Skin website and they're like, oh no, someone's already done this. And so, you know, it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek book. I didn't really even know what it was when I first took the job. I needed the money. And it sounded kind of interesting to work on something that was kind of an in-house production. It was not until later that I learned what it was. And so, but it was a lot of fun. And Mr. Skin himself, his real name is Jim McBride, is a really sweet guy. I got very close with him, and his family. He's got a lot of family members who work, at the company with him. I got friendly with a lot of his employees, did a lot of interviews with them. I got to work with the great underground comics, creator Johnny Ryan, who actually co-created a show on Nickelodeon called Pig, Goat, Banana, Cricket, or something like that. and I got to work with him on some comic strips that we did for the book. We got Adam Carolla to do the forward, which was really cool. It was really cool talking with Adam. And, you know, it was a fun book. It's, you know, I don't want to say it's totally safe for work, but we made it more PG-13, less R. And we even talk about kind of the sort of stuff that he does. But the truth be told, it's one of the first commercially successful websites of all time. It just celebrated its 20th anniversary. It launched before Google. It launched, obviously, before a lot of social media stuff. He really was figuring out how to create online entrepreneurship and how to learn a lot. In fact, we've been trying to get the book out there, not just as a pop culture book, but also as a business manual, because he really gives a lot of good information about how he was able to make the company so successful, how he survived the dot-com bubble burst in 2001. A lot of companies like his were all going under. He survived and actually flourished during that time. So, you know, that was a fun project to work on. It's called Being Mr. Skin. It was distributed by Simon & Schuster this year as well. And then, of course, the 5th anniversary edition of Slimed came out. I think it's both Kindle and hardcover. I know it's hardcover. And that's got, you know, a couple little updates. Yes, to be honest, there's not as much stuff that's different about it than I would have liked, but I'm just happy that Penguin Random House let me do this to begin with, and we have a really great new introduction from Phil Moore, along with a few other little tweaks and some changes stuff, as well as some autograph pages in the back. We put in some autograph pages as autograph on. I know a lot of people are using their books as kind of a passport to get signatures from different Nick VIPs and such. So that came out this year. And then finally, most exciting, just because it's totally new for me, is I actually have a comic book series that just issue number one came out about 3 weeks ago. It's called You Are Obsolete. It came out through a company called Aftershock. A lot of old Marvel and DC people, they're working on a new project with Garth Ennis, who created Preacher. They're working on a new project with R.L. Stein of Goosebumps, which is kind of cool. They've done some other really great projects. And so this project of mine is called You Are Obsolete. It's 5 issues. The first one just came out. And then there's going to be a new one every month through the end of January. The next one actually comes out October 23rd, issue 2. And yeah, that was just a really fun process. I had to learn how to write comics. I'm not a big comics guy myself. I kind of happened through happenstance. But that's been great. And I'm starting to develop a few new comics. And then I'm working on just a few other new proposals. And we're trying to get a cartoon series that I've been picking at with a friend on and off the last couple of years going. Worked with some of the Simpsons people on that called CIA Moms. I'm working on a few new documentaries, you know, very slowly. You know, a lot of this stuff, again, you know, costs money, don't make money in the beginning. so I have to kind of pick and choose what I'm working on at different times. I have a new book coming out next year, my first middle grade reader, called The Kids That Would Meet Junior High Take Over the World, loosely based on a band that I've worked with over the years called The Kids That Would Meet High, made up of young adults with developmental disabilities. We're hoping that'll be the first part of a series that comes out, I think, winter 2020. And anything that anybody wants to see that I'm working on or that I'm doing, or if you're interested in any of the projects that I've been talking about, as well as just upcoming events that I might be involved in, or other little reunions or panels or things that I'm always putting together, you can see all of that on my website. That's kept very up to date, www.matthewklickstein.com. That's MATHEWKLICKSTEIN.com. Yes, I do have one T in my name. The nurse misspelled my name on the birth certificate. I was actually born in my house because my mom was afraid of doctors, so she had a midwife come. And so
I was wondering about that, why there was only one T.
It's not an affectation, yeah. I never liked my first name. I thought it was like just too common. There was always another Matt in class with me. I was always Matt K. Funnily enough, I've always been really good friends with the other Matt. Like, many of my best friends over the years have been named Matt. But I don't know, it seems common, a little too popular and such. So it wasn't until a little later down the road that I realized that my name was actually spelled with one T when I was getting my driver's license. And we had a look at my birth certificate, and sure enough, it was spelled with one T. And then I just realized, hey, that's a way to kind of make my name a little less common. Because that was also around the same time that I started getting published. As I said, it started when I was around 15 professionally. And so I was like, oh, if I use one T, that way I've got kind of a unique name. Especially since, believe it or not, there actually is another Matthew Klickstein in the world. I've actually never met him. We've never communicated with each other. I would imagine he knows of me. I know of him. But, yeah, he's, I think, in his late 40s. I think he's like a bartender / rock musician in Brooklyn or something like that. I looked him up once or twice. There's really not a lot of information about him. And yeah, so I know a little bit, and I've never talked with any of my my family, my dad's family, about, like, you know, because there's a bunch of Klickstein's just kind of spread all over, and not everybody's in touch with each other. So, but yeah, so that's another thing too, is it separates me from the other Matthew Klickstein that exists.
That's right, and the one T in your name definitely makes you unique. So there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, uh-huh. I hope so.
Yeah, I would think so. So we'll be sure to look for your new revised version of Slimed and your Simpsons book and everything else that's been going on. That's just about going to do it this week. I was going to get to some other sports scores, but I'll probably go over that a little bit more next week, I think, on the show as we get back to the more sports and entertainment talk. Matt, thank you so much for doing this.
You were one of
my best interviews yet. I had to just sit back and just listen to you. I felt like I was, you're almost like a teacher or professor at some point. You really just are an incredible wealth of knowledge and passion. Anytime you want to come back on the show again, or if I want to do something that you're doing, please reach out to me and let me know. I would love to.
Yeah, vice versa. I'm always happy if something comes up about, like, The Simpsons or something you want to talk to me about. I'm always available, you know, doing my own podcast stuff, my own interviews, my own journalism work, and having a lot of friends in the industry as well. I really appreciate when people put as much time and energy into it as you have, John. And, you know, there are people I've been interviewed by where, you know, you sit there and you say, gosh, they're ruining it for everybody else. You know, they're not doing that great of a job, or it just feels like a waste of time for you or whatever it is. But when it works, like your show did and your interview did, you know, I appreciate it, and I will always be available for you. So thank you for having me on the show, and I'd be happy to do more, and I'll certainly let you know when I have other things coming out over the next couple of years as I do. And I thank you again for letting me be on the show.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure. And if you want to listen to this and plenty of other exclusive content, you can listen to this on EPRN, our Sports and Stuff app. We'll also be doing an extra interview as well with Matt at some point soon, so be sure to listen to that. And he's got a lot of other stuff coming out. He's definitely making a name for himself, so be sure to check out his latest stuff on MatthewKlickstein.com and all of his other books and publications he's got going on. That's going to do it here for us this week on the show. Again, special thanks to Matt Klickstein for doing this. Tremendous guest this week. We'll be back with more sports and entertainment next week on the program. For everybody involved with this one, I'm John Meisner. For Matthew Klickstein and myself, thanks for listening, everybody. And like we said earlier, get out there and listen to, watch some old shows. That's the biggest lesson we have this week. You watch old stuff. The newer stuff is crap. Okay, so just watch older stuff. and you'll gain an appreciation for it, hopefully, like we did. So for everybody involved with this one, have a great week, everybody. Enjoy fall, and we'll be back next week with more of Sports and Stuff. This is John Meiser signing off, saying, take care, everybody. Have a great week. So long.